89 AU 105.7 FM, Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson, is going to be here talking about the prevailing wage, the theft of prevailing wage that didn't happen here yesterday in the state of Pennsylvania, as the righties not happy. Not happy that they weren't able to lower the wages of workers. It always ticks them off. It always makes them a little cranky. When they can't stick it to the working people of the state and across the country. So we'll talk to Irwin about that. Also on the program, Joe Rome, a fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, also the editor of the Climate Progress blog, going to be here talking about the big find, the Heartland Foundation, Heartland Institute. Someone leaked all of their fundraising information and their donors and their big plans to go after climate change. Yeah, you know, we've always known. We know where the money's coming from. We know who's behind all of the attacks. We know it. This is just more proof. And, you know, their goal was, well, we're going to go after kids. We're going to go after kids so that they don't believe anything that man-made climate change is even possible. And it reminded me of the Fracosaurus, Talisman Terry. The natural gas industry, the drillers up here in Pennsylvania, they put out a coloring book for kids to show how wonderful fracking is. And that the Fracosaurus was a good thing, big smiles, happy smiling people. So we'll talk to Joe Rome about the release and, you know, what it really means to the whole movement and how we combat it. Also in the second hour, Captain Mike Riley going to be here, Teamster, on the privatization of prisons and a big victory in Florida yesterday as the Senate there decided, you know what, maybe privatizing our prisons is not such a great idea after all. It was a 21-19 vote. So private prison people, not happy. And in the third hour, Alexis Goldstein going to be here. She is with the Occupy the SEC movement, and you're going to hear to be talking about their 325-page list of demands and how we turn this country around. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Something on your mind, question, comment, you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. The best way to go about that. So the big news today, kind of in and out, is the payroll tax going to happen? Did they make another agreement that they're going to go back on? At first we thought, hey, there's going to be an agreement. Congressional negotiators said they had reached a deal to extend the payroll tax holiday and the unemployment benefits. They said that yesterday. Now, not so sure. Boehner says maybe there's going to be a vote Friday. We don't know. All indications looked as there weren't going to be any massive offsets. We're going to have to steal from children and steal from old people. That we were just going to say, you know what, the economy needs the unemployment benefits. We need the stimulus of the payroll tax holiday. We need to get that into people's hands. Thought they were going to do that. And they still may, But you don't know what the T-Twits are going to do. There's still a chance that they will derail the whole deal. Now, what you've got is you've got Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, or Minority Leader McConnell, kind of staying away from it. As of now, I haven't seen whether he's endorsed the deal or not. So I'm guessing since I haven't seen anything, it means he hasn't. But I think he's kind of waiting to see what happens with the T-Twits. He's not going to put his neck out on the line, and we'll see. I mean, you know, they're still tomorrow and Friday before they go on their week-long vacation next week, so it'll be interesting. But originally, some of the numbers that I had seen was a 10-month extension of the payroll tax break. So a 10-month, take us right to the end of 2012, get us past the election, and they weren't going to demand offsets or cutting, you know, social programs or anything. So, which I thought was pretty good. There's also the doc fix was part of it, which would prevent some of the healthcare budget cuts, that are going in there. We are going to see some preventative care, though, being slashed. So I guess what we're doing is and it's one of those things that kind of bothers me. Anytime we take from the future, and we take from prevention and research or education and we give it to, you know, short term. We're paying the doctors more, which we should be, but we're going to kind of pull back on preventative care, which makes me think, well, how much is it going to cost us down the road? Just another thought. The unemployment extension, that's going to go through, like I said, as part of this deal. But who's going to pay for it? Well, they're going to go after federal pensions. So you federal folks, well, you're going to end up getting the short end of that stick. The compromise on the number of weeks of unemployment, I guess they've reached, were 73. Wasn't 99 as the Democrats wanted. Wasn't 59 that the Republicans wanted. They've settled on 73. So maybe we'll see. I'm kind of looking to see which way this goes. Could go either way at this point. So you're looking at a possibility of Friday being the vote day. Anyway, today in the House, they held a hearing. Geithner sat in front of the House Ways and Means Committee. And, you know, like any time Geithner goes before the Republicans, they just pound him. And it's interesting because he was their guy. I mean, he was a Bush guy. And I don't think many people remember this, but he was Bush's guy that Obama just kept. And, you know, they go after him with such anger. I mean, you know, Dave Camp, the guy who is the chairman of the committee, just really went after him. And he said, look, you know, the reality is we kept trying to tell you what our idea of reforming the tax codes were. We kept trying to do that during the debt talks. And you guys left the table three times. And if you remember that whole debacle, that whole hostage situation, the big crisis that they made out of it, that ultimately caused our credit rating to go down, the Republicans kept leaving the room. You begin to talk about it, they'd stick their fingers in their ear, they'd get up, and, you know, like two-year-olds, march right out the door. And, you know, how can you have any real talks with people like that? So he's saying that. He goes, look, you know, we tried. You know, we've laid it out. We've done as much as we can do. And, you know, it got heated back and forth. And I like what Jim McDermott said. It's one of those things that, you know, finally somebody spoke up and said something about it. Because we're going back and we're going to have the conversation about the tax reform bill of 86. Because we're going to do the exact same thing. Understand, the Obama people want to do what they did in 86. And Geithner has said, yeah, you know, we've got a broad framework on corporate tax reform, and they're going to put it out in a couple of weeks. But he said, you know, look, the administration wants to bring down the top rate, you know, to the average of our major competitors. So like I've been saying, look out, here it comes. And I like what Jim McDermott said, the Democrat from Washington. He said that, you know, remembering back to the 86, when the Reagan administration got this tax reform bill pushed through, McDermott said it took 6 years of golf, cigar smoking, and drinking whiskey between the White House and congressional leaders to reach an agreement. Which, yeah, I mean, you know, this is a whole backroom deal. Okay, we'll give up some of the cherished tax breaks and the cherished loopholes, and we'll lower the rate. So that, you know, we're basically giving everything away lowering the rate, and letting the people who were using the loopholes not have to do it anymore, which was kind of dumb. But everybody said, oh, it's a great idea. We lowered the rate and, you know, took those loopholes away, and we did away with all those nasty loopholes. Understand, I'm a big fan of using tax incentive to get things that we want done. You want solar energy? You need to have a tax credit for it. You want manufacturing? What do we keep hearing? All the politicians, even Obama, all of them, talking about, oh, well, we want to bring manufacturing back. We're going to double your tax credit. Yeah, well, who's going to pay for that? If we're lowering the tax rate again, who's going to pay for those tax breaks? Who's going to continue to pay for it? I'm a huge fan of going back and undoing what we did in 86 and saying, okay, we're going to have a super high tax rate. And you polluters, you're going to pay that top tax rate. But we're going to give tax breaks for people who clean up the air. We're going to give people tax breaks for manufacturing things that we need. We're going to give tax breaks to people who employ folks. Lots of those. But the righties, that's too difficult. We don't want to pay any tax. So we end up with a situation where now we're talking about, we're still going to give them out because it's politically popular. It's politically popular to give out tax breaks and incentives because companies love to gobble them up and entrepreneurs love to gobble them up because, hey, it's almost like free money. But nobody wants to pay the bill. And who ends up footing the bill? Well, you and I do. So we end up looking at a scenario where the Republicans refuse to allow taxes to be raised on the wealthy folks, on people making over $1 million. Will not, under any circumstances, go there. They want to go and they want to take from Medicare and they want to take from social programs and they want to kick people off of food stamps and they want to kick people off of unemployment when there are no jobs out there. Yeah, you know, that's what they want. And they still want roads and bridges and military spending and all that other stuff. But again, no way of raising revenue. And I'm still trying to figure out this confidence fairy they keep talking about. That somehow if we cut, gut, and punish and we take enough out of the economy, enough government spending, enough state spending, we take enough of that out, somehow it'll magically grow by itself. It's kind of like saying, oh yeah, I'm watering my garden, but I didn't put any seeds in it. Kind of like that, I think. But anyway, the hearing today got a little testy, and Geithner finally, you know, at one point was pushed where he was asked about the administration's plan. He said, well, you know, it's just as good as the chairman's. The guy who is the chairman of the board, Camp's plan, it's as detailed as his. And the only thing we saw in Camp's plan is that he wants to lower the top marginal rate from the top rate from 35 down to 25. So again, you know, it's one of those things where you just kind of, you just get to shake your head and go, well, where are we going with all of this? And you know where it goes. It goes where you and I, well, we get screwed on this. And it's coming. Anyway, also, in Congress, Majority Leader Harry Reid said he's going to allow a vote on the Republican Senate's bill to repeal the Obama's birth control policy. I'm not sure if that's coming sometime today. Sponsored by Roy Blunt. We talked about it yesterday. Not going to pass. But what it is it's a, and this is, I guess, Reid, you know, saying, look, we've got some pro-life Democrats who, it's an election time, and I think of Bob Casey. You know, he's got to stand out there and say, yes, I'm pro-life, and I'm going to stand against this, which, again, I'm not so sure is a great idea. But it is what it is. Now, the Catholics are all happy about that. They're also all wired up. One bishop said that there needed to be a violent opposition to this contraception bill, to this policy. Violent, violent opposition. Wow. Anyway, we're going to talk about all of that today, much more, the attacks on working people, the attacks on the poor, all of that and much more, and who's paying for it behind the curtain. Quick break, right back after this with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Stick around, right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says President Obama's budget would put America on the right path towards building a solid foundation for our economic future. The Labor Federation says the president's proposed investments in infrastructure, clean energy, manufacturing, education, and innovation will help build that economic foundation that we all need. The AFL-CIO is also praising Obama's efforts to end tax breaks for shipping jobs overseas and to beef up enforcement of trade agreements. Asking millionaires to pay more taxes at the same effective rate as working families is also a fiscal step in the right direction, according to the AFL-CIO. America, the Labor Federation says, has to decide between repeating the same mistakes that led to 2008's financial crash or learning from them and rebuilding our economy on a stronger foundation. California's South Bay Labor Council is fighting a move by the San Jose City Council to cut city worker pensions without collectively bargaining over the issue. Cindy Chavez is executive officer of the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council. She says this attack on collective bargaining and vested worker pension rights is illegal, but the city is putting the question on the ballot anyway.
This is a frontal attack on vested rights. And even though they know that this is illegal, and I believe they do know that, they're willing to put it on the ballot, and they're willing to risk the city coffers to break the unions, and meaning that this is not about the budget. This is absolutely about showing dominance and breaking the labor movement here and across the country.
Michigan state employee unions are challenging a law passed in 2011 that requires workers employed since 1997 to switch pensions to a 401k-style plan that's dependent on the stock market or stick with the current plan but contribute 4%. New employees are required to take the 401k-style plan. Five unions are jointly filing a suit on behalf of more than 30,000 state workers in Michigan. The lawsuit alleges that the new law is unconstitutional and that it needed to go through the Civil Service Commission before being enacted. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by the United Steelworkers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, I was thinking about that article yesterday in the New York Times, how we've seen these anti-poverty programs that, you know, for the longest time were for, you know, people who are pretty down on the socioeconomic ladder, how they've been expanded because what we've seen is we've seen the ladder kind of collapsing. We've seen middle-class families falling deeper and deeper into down the ladder and into poverty, that there's so many people now who need it. And what I've been kind of amused at and really kind of frustrated with is the assaults against those programs and ultimately the people against them. It's just mind-blowing. Anyway, I've got our good friend Erwin Aronson on the line. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, good to be here, Rick. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm looking at that article that I was talking about yesterday, and you know, I remember as a kid having to, when my mother needed to collect welfare and we had to take food stamps to the store, the looks and the degrading environment that it was in, and all you needed was a little helping hand. We're still pushing that, and it seems pretty hard right now.
Well, it is pretty hard, and I don't want anybody to make a mistake in reviewing that New York Times article. It is not that these programs have expanded. It is that the people who need them the numbers of those folks have expanded pretty dramatically, actually.
Yep.
And that's what this is about. The poverty line has actually gone down, the dollar amount in real dollars, over the last couple of decades pretty substantially. But nonetheless, the people who need the assistance and attention and help of those programs in this very, very protracted and difficult jobless recovery of our economy has expanded greatly, and it's an interesting phenomenon because the right wing that sort of attempts to tell the story or define the story on these programs does so on behalf of their large, wealthy corporate financiers. But the appeal that they make is to working folks, and they attempt in regular and pointed ways to sway or skew the view of working people to have working people and working families. Middle class folks believe that somehow the enemy is that group of people who needs this important safety net, this lifeline of modest, limited public benefits, when indeed the real culprits here are the bankers and the insurers and the others who have decimated and destroyed our economy to a point where the middle class has been beaten to a pulp, and now what we really are seeing is a redefinition and a recognition that the middle class is what's shrinking, and the people who need these programs in numbers are expanding, and expanding rapidly and dramatically.
Yeah, and as I read through the article, I'm thinking, you know, at no point are they talking about the recession. At no point are they talking about what caused this to happen was this massive collapse of our economy and the millions of jobs that were lost. It wasn't about that. Now it's about that Horatio Alger story. You need people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and we don't need these. It's really bizarre to me.
Well, it's really, really hard for anyone to pull themselves up by their bootstraps when there's a bank or an insurance company or a company like the Revel Casino that we talked about a couple of weeks ago that automatically tells people they lose their jobs after 6 years, all having their foot on the victim's neck. And that's really the problem. And unfortunately, the New York Times article focused on the public benefits instead of focusing on the causes for the need for public benefits.
Yeah, because I don't begrudge anybody any help. I really don't. I mean, if you need to, you need a helping hand, I think about my own life. I've been very fortunate in that there have been a number of programs that our government and we the people have decided that were beneficial, and they benefited me, and now I have no problem reaching backwards and helping someone else. I don't. And I don't think as a society we should.
Well, clearly as a society we should not, and I have a personal background that's not dramatically dissimilar from yours, in which I too was the recipient of the value of things like food stamps, like public assistance, like medical assistance in my childhood long after my father passed away and my mother was very ill. But the fact of the matter is that we cannot be misled into thinking that these kinds of legs that we help people to stand on are for their benefit alone. We need to recognize that every person that is getting public assistance or medical assistance or food stamps or other kinds of help in these fashions isn't saving money. They're not going on trips to Hawaii. They're not buying new cars. This is subsistence, and that subsistence is spent on grocery bills, on doctor bills, on shoes and utilities like electricity and gas and telephone, all of which are the fundamental sustenance of life, but all of the real beneficiaries of these things are the grocery stores and the electric company and the gas company and the phone companies and the landlords who are not getting a break in their income stream that they depend upon and that they count on so that they can have their vacations and their fancy cars, financed, of course, by the people who have been the victims of this explosively depressed economy. And so we need to also recognize that virtually every single dollar of money that makes its way into the hands of recipients of these kinds of assistance is being spent to prop up businesses in our community, and that, of course, protects other people's jobs, in addition to protecting the incomes of the people who own those businesses and who are walking away with much, much, much more than mere subsistence.
You know, I don't think I'm cynical in saying that, you know, I think there's a movement afoot that wants to destroy these programs, has wanted to destroy them from the beginning, but even more so now because of the politics that are going on, that if we can slow this economy down a little bit, make the recovery a little slower, that we get that black guy out of the White House.
Well, I think that that's very, very aptly said, and I think that there's one other thing. When people of one political persuasion or another really have no solutions for the real and meaningful problems that we face, they are willing to bite the political bullet on and pursue, not for their private self or self-interest, but for the public good, for the interest of our state and for our country, the next thing they do instead of doing their jobs is to tell us that we should hate each other. And the Occupy movement has pointed this out with crystal clarity over what is now getting to be several months. We are the 99%, and it's the 1% that is suggesting that we somehow have an obligation to kick our fellow brothers and sisters when they're down instead of identifying our true opponents in all of this.
And since you bring that up, you know, yesterday, I guess the vote didn't happen on the attack on prevailing wage. You know, and I look at this and I say, you know, I thought we were talking about jobs. I thought November of 2010, it was supposed to be a laser-like focus on jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet all I see is a bunch of nonsense, renaming bridges and attacking workers' rights. How is any of that creating jobs?
Well, in a word or two words, it's not. What it is doing is, once again, reallocating the focus of the argument. And this is a particularly nasty and cynical one, because what we have here is a never-ending series of parliamentary moves and proposals by Mike Terzai, the majority leader of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, who in his capacity as the floor leader controls the calendar of what gets voted on in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, coming time and time again in an effort to use our government by way of our elected representatives, who are sworn to uphold and protect our Constitution and our laws, to use that very, very important and solemn commitment and promise to put the government of our state in the position of using its substantial power to cut people's wages and to slash our own local community standards and to use taxpayer money to do so. And that is the most shocking and offensive of all. Fortunately, to this point, the working people of Pennsylvania, not merely and not only construction workers, but industrial workers, public employees, private sector employees, service workers in all manner of industries, have really and truly risen up and communicated clearly and effectively with members of the General Assembly in both the Democratic and Republican parties, by the way, and have discouraged to, at least at the moment, a point that this legislation hasn't come to a vote. But this battle is certainly not over. This keeps coming back. Most recently, last night or earlier today, again, Representative Terzai attempted to basically ignore his own established procedural rules inside the Pennsylvania House of Representatives and amend a bill that had already passed its period of time during which amendments could be offered, just so that they could try to keep this ball in the air of the government being used as the basically springboard, if you will, to cut people's wages and to destroy our community standards and use taxpayer money to do so.
What's amazing to me are the people who tell me they hate government the most and they want small, less intrusive government. They seem to be the ones who are out there forcing their will upon us with the government. I look at this, you know, this whole latest thing over contraception, which is just nuts to me that you've got the Catholic Church wanting the government to enforce, you know, against their parishioners, no contraception. I mean, it's nuts to me.
Well, it's the whole thing is all turned on its head. They have advocated for years this unexplained, if you will, concept of getting the government back off our back. And they want to take the government off our back and put it in our bedrooms. They want to take the government off our back and put it in our kitchen tables. Take the government off our back and put it in every aspect of our lives. And while they talk about deregulating and they talk about these regulations that are somehow onerous on businesses, what they're really saying is they want to get rid of particular regulations, those that protect children, those that protect workers, those that protect the elderly, those that protect people in need of medical care. Get rid of all of those, but at the same time impose all these other regulations that allows the government to tell me what I'm allowed to say to my wife, yep. Allows the government to impose itself on my relationship with my children. And that's really not just wrong. That's an outrage.
And what's amazing to me is, you know, for all of this fervor about, you know, we get the government out between me and my doctor over the healthcare thing, they want to put the government right between a woman and her doctor when or their insurance company. It's mind-blowing.
Oh, it is beyond mind-blowing. It is cynical, and it needs to be exposed. And one of the things that's a blessing in this country is that we have the opportunity guaranteed by our Constitution and the people guaranteed through folks like you to be able to talk about these things and demonstrate not merely the irony, but the absolute cynicism of political operatives who say one thing and do something else.
Well, let me ask you this last series of questions I've got for you. You know, Mitch McConnell said the other day that he believes that an employer should be able to, and you know, this just blows my mind, to deny coverage or to do whatever he wants for his employees if he has a moral objection. And I'm going, well, how far does that go?
Well, it goes apparently as far as Mitch McConnell decides it ought to go, because apparently Mitch McConnell is the ultimate arbiter of our individual rights.
And I guess
shocking as it may seem, this is, of course, the same Mitch McConnell who, on the one hand, thought it was outrageous to participate in providing some assistance to the automobile industry, which has been an extraordinary and breathtaking success. He opposed that, but when the Harley-Davidson plant in York, Pennsylvania, was having some minor economic difficulty, he suggested and proposed something like $100 million federal dollars of free assistance to Harley-Davidson to move the plant from York, Pennsylvania, and reestablish it in his home state of Kentucky.
Yeah, I remember that deal. It was almost $250 million total package, if I remember right.
No, it was better part of $250 million, $100 million of which would have come not from anybody inside Kentucky, but from the taxpayers of Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, et cetera, that Mitch McConnell, from his special vantage point, would have been able to impose.
You got to love Beggar Thy Neighbor economic development. Irwin, always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity. So be well, be safe, take care, and hopefully I get to talk with you again next week.
All right. We'll see you next week, our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Barack Obama was right on target 2 years ago when he denounced the Supreme Court for allowing unlimited corporate cash to flood into our elections, calling it a, quote, threat to democracy. But now the gushers of that money are pouring into this year's Republican presidential campaigns through super PACs. He has pivoted adroitly from condemning such corrupt funds to creating one of his own. Savvy or cynical? I call it sad. Not because Obama wouldn't stand on principle, but because his switch affirms that special interest money now governs us, too powerful for even the sitting president to resist. These super PACs, all of which are creatures of a handful of rich Americans, were already the biggest power in the Republican presidential contest. Frontrunner Mitt Romney's last name is even an anagram that spells M-O-N-E-Y. And a $30 million super PAC financed chiefly by Wall Streeters has powered him to the front. They want to buy a president who'll undo Obama's financial reform law that restrains some of their greed. That's what our democracy has become. Sad. Rather than taking the high road and rallying a public that's thoroughly disgusted by this, Obama now joins Romney et al. On the money-slick low road. His super PAC, named Priorities USA, is as corrupt as the Republicans. All of them perpetuate the ludicrous legalistic fraud that the secretive funds operate independently of the candidates. Come on, hand puppets act with more independence than super PACs. While Obama piously says that he won't work directly with a PAC, he's directed cabinet officials and White House aides to rustle up big donors to fund it. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we're getting this year is not a presidential election, it's an auction. To help repeal the Supreme Court's money rule, go to unitedforthepeople.org. That's united, the number four, thepeople.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Do you advocate getting rid of the minimum wage? Would that create more jobs?
Absolutely, and it would help the poor, the people who need a job. The minimum wage is a mandate. We're against mandates, so why should we have it? No, it would be very beneficial.
Everything's raising but the wages. Everything's raising but the wages. Gasoline closes and our raises. Everything's raising but the wages.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Something on your mind, questions, comments. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast from the website, therickSmithShow.com, of course, or get the Stitcher app for your smartphone and take the program on the go. So like I said at the beginning, you know, this Heartland Institute, somebody leaked out their fundraising information. And you go, gee, where'd all the money come from? Who's funding all of this stuff? And it's all the usual suspects, the Kochs, the billionaires, the big multi-billionaire people. A lot of money there, out there to push their message. And their message is never our message. Not at all, which is why I find it quite amusing. And one of those things I think that the right is now looking down on the NASCAR people as much as the far left probably looks down on the NASCAR people. This group, American Majority, another one of these front groups, these T-Twizzler groups, although they call themselves nonpartisan. They're a Tea Party group, but they're nonpartisan. They're going to be the first political group to sponsor a NASCAR, and the driver. The NASCAR will be driven by Jason Bowles and the McDonald's motorsports car number 81 will be his car. For the entire 2012 nationwide series, I guess there are going to be 14 races up until the presidential election. And the first race will be at the Daytona 500, where you'll see the nice red, white, and blue car with Keep America Free on one end and American Majority Racing on the other, and then Pledge to Vote on the sides. Trying to get people to, hopefully, in their minds, hopefully to get conservatives to vote, because maybe they've bought into what the mean has been about NASCAR, is that it's conservatives. It's all a bunch of crazy right-wingers. And a lot of the people that I know, the outwardly ones, the ones who buy the jackets and wear the hats and cried when the guy died, those are the I think the conservatives. Everybody else who watches it and kind of, pays attention a little bit, maybe not so much. In fact, there's been some polling done by the Media Audit National Report for 2010, and they found that 27.2% of NASCAR fans said that they were Democrats. 30% said they were Republicans, and 35% said they were independents. Kind of interesting. So what you've done now is they've now gone into what they believe is the bastion of conservatism, NASCAR, with a seven-figure buy. So you're talking over $1 million to buy into sponsoring this car. And where do they get that money? Well, according to reports, they're funded pretty heavily by the conservative Bradley Foundation, another one of these places that big bucks. And, a lot of us for years have been saying that what we should be doing with politics is we should just be giving them jackets. Everyone in Congress should get a jacket, and you put patches on. Who owns you? Put patches on, or in the Supreme Court, put robes on with patches, who owns who. Probably make it a lot easier. And there was an article today that I came across, I think it was the Washington Post, that pointed out that Gingrich has been pumping this idea of Lean Six Sigma, which is some kind of business management concept. Where, you know, their idea is, you know, you train these people on how to, you know, how to cut spending and how to, it's a whole mindset. Well, he's been out there pushing this, and the guy who came up with this idea and has written six books on this Lean Sigma, Six Sigma, a guy named Mike George, he's the guy who started, you know, one of these big super PACs, called Strong America Now, which he created and solely funds. And, well, it's been solely promoting Gingrich. So you've got this super PAC with a boatload of money in it promoting Gingrich. You've got Gingrich, who's been out on the stump and during his campaign appearances, the debates even, has at least mentioned Lean Six Sigma 28 times. So you're looking at this and you go, you got this situation where super PACs, they can raise unlimited amounts of money. They can spend unlimited amounts of money. And it doesn't matter where it comes from. Nobody needs to know. No one's allowed to know. Is this bad for democracy? Because now you've got a clear situation where you've got a presidential candidate running around pushing this guy's agenda. And him on the other side with the ability to raise and spend unlimited money promoting him. Is there something there? Do you think there's a conflict? Now some people would say, well, you know, he's, you know, the reason that he started the super PAC is because, you know, Gingrich is onto his ideas and Gingrich is promoting his ideas. So he's coming along after the fact. But I'm looking at this going, you know, the appearance to me is kind of dangerous. It appears that, you know, outwardly, that there's some kind of quid pro quo, and that there could be. I'm not saying that there is, but there could be. And is this what we're going to see going forward with more campaigns? I mean, will Obama do it? Will Obama come out and one of the big funders say, you know what, I'd like you to drop my website a couple of times? Are we going to have a situation where, you know, we get to the point, I don't know if there are any boxing fans, but I remember a time, you know, about 10 years ago, all the boxers would come out with goldenpalace.com, magic markered on their back. So that while they're fighting, you would see goldenpalace.com. And they'd get like $10,000 or $15,000 per fight. Just somebody put a magic marker on their back. Is that what we're going to do with politics? I sure hope not. Maybe, well, hey, it's turned almost into a circus anyway, as boxing did back then with that nonsense. I'm glad they stopped it. But is that where we're heading? I mean, because you look at all the money that's being thrown around. And, you know, as reports have come out, you know, they keep saying, well, Obama's getting money from Wall Street. He's getting a little bit, yeah. In fact, he got somewhere around $5.1 million from the financial, the insurance, and the real estate sectors. So far this cycle, compare that to the 12.4 that Romney got, there is a massive push of money against Obama. And in fact, it's against the Democrats because we're seeing that that same sector has given, well, $12.4 million to Republicans. So you're seeing a lot of money going that after them, and the big PAC money. You look at Romney's big PAC, Restore Our Future. Don't you love those names? I mean, aren't they fantastic? Strong America Now, Restore Our Future. Really euphemistic, nonsensical names. When, you know, you think about Romney's PAC, you know, put him in there, gonna tear this country to hell. But anyway, they've raised some $30.1 million last year. So they've hauled in a ton of money. So I think it's one of those things that's really, really dangerous. And you know why Wall Street's backing Romney? They want their boy in there. They want their boy in there so they can go back to the good old days. Back to the good old days of the Bush policies. Get rid of that Dodd-Frank. So we can go back to having banks being gambling casinos again. And we can come up with those cute little things like derivatives and mortgage-backed securities and you know, all that wonderful stuff that we were able to screw people out of billions and billions of dollars in. I mean, that's where they want to go back to. The wheeling and dealing of the great late 90s and all through the 2000s. Why? Because they benefit. And understand, money gets what money wants because we keep buying into it. Every time one of those negative ads goes on, I remember people calling me saying, oh, did you see that? Did you see what Obama wants to do? He wants to give prescription drugs to people. Well, yeah, he wants to give contraception to people. He's for abortion. Well, I think he is, but he's not promoting it on the street corner. It's kind of, these ads are just, they're meant to play to the worst of us. They're meant to tear us down. And I guess it works, which is why they're spending so much money on it. And we'll see if this NASCAR thing works. It will be interesting to watch, although I don't watch NASCAR. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk. Together we will live on forevermore. Now we have defended from all things that we could. Now we are defensive. The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Paleontologists have wondered why mammals, including humans, evolved to have larger brains than other animals.
A team of scientists now believes that large brains might have developed in mammals first in order to facilitate a good sense of smell. Results of this study appeared in May 2011 in the journal Science. The team examined rare 190 million-year-old fossil skulls of two of the earliest known mammal species, tiny, furry creatures no bigger than a paperclip.
These minuscule mammals from the Jurassic fossil beds of China had much larger brains than expected for their size. In particular, said the science team, the olfactory part of the brain, used in the sense of smell, was enlarged in these early mammals.
These scientists said this discovery wouldn't have been possible without CT scanning technology. They were able to use CT scans to peer into these tiny skulls without damaging them. Without this technology to get this result and this insight into the brains of these tiny early mammals, scientists would have had to break open these rare and precious fossil skulls.
Early mammals would have used their sense of smell to find food, find a mate, and detect physical danger. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at EarthSky.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, on the way into work today, I stopped off and I got gas and I'm going, you know, why is it that the prices are through the roof? Why is it that it's $3.55 a gallon and, I'm told it's going to be $4 before May? Why is it that high? You go back and you listen to Rick Santorum, he's telling us, and you know, hey, you know, maybe Rick, maybe he knows something we don't. Maybe the great collapse of 2008 had nothing to do, with all of the crummy mortgages that were written, all of the illegal activity. Maybe it had nothing to do with that. Maybe Santorum was right. Maybe it was the cost of energy, because people were paying for their air conditioning and the heat their homes instead of, and gasoline, of course, instead of paying for their mortgage. Maybe the luxury of air conditioning was more important than the mortgage. I'm not sure where those people are, but, you know, according to Tricky Ricky, that's what brought down the economy, the energy prices. And I'm looking, I'm going, right now, they're talking we could be back up to $4 a gallon by May, if not sooner. And you look at the reality is we're using considerably less gasoline. We're shipping it out of the country. We're shipping energy out of the country. Why is it so high? Well, I think it's pretty simple why it's so high. A couple reasons. One, collusion. You've got all of these oil companies going, well, we've got them used to paying it. Let's just keep charging them that. Because, you know, isn't it amazing to you how all these different companies are out there and they're all within a penny or two of each other? It's called collusion. They all set the price. And the bigger part, I do believe, is the fact that still, in this day and age, even after some of the legislation that's been passed to try and combat it, you still have these speculators, these Wall Street hedge fund managers and these people jacking up the price. And I was talking to a guy today, a retiree, and he goes, you know, I just don't get it. I don't understand why it's so high. You know, we've got more fuel-efficient cars. We're using less fuel. You know, we're doing more drilling. We're doing more energy production of our own. Yet we're closing down refineries like they're doing in Philadelphia. They're closing three refineries. You go, well, what's the point in all this? Well, the point is to keep us paying, to keep in our pockets. So the speculators, the big Wall Street hedge fund managers, they can put money in their pocket at our expense. You want to talk about redistribution of wealth? Here it is, my friends. Right here, this is it. This is redistributing wealth from you and me who have to get up every day and go to work and take our kids to school and go to the store to do our grocery shopping and do all of those things that we do in our lives and have to use our car for. They know they've got us. They got us by the short hairs. And the reality is when that tanker leaves the Middle East or that tanker leaves Venezuela, while it's floating over here, they're buying and selling it. Buying and selling, jacking the price up. Because they know you're going to buy it. You don't have a choice. And this is where, you know, I go back to the people who tell me, Rick, you just don't understand the free market. I do understand the free market. I understand that in the free market, in the true free market, if we've ever had one, and we don't, we've never had a true free market. Maybe back when we were trading fur and bone and meat, maybe when we were actually trading actual things and didn't have a currency, maybe that was a true free market. Because you then had the ability to walk away. You had your wares, and if you didn't want to trade for what the other person, you could walk away. I that was probably the last time we had a true free market. But since we decided that we're going to use some type of currency, there's always been someone trying to figure out how to game the system. And this is what's going on. They know they got us by the short hair. They know you're not going to be able to drive your car with vegetable oil. Most people aren't going to go through that. They know that the electric car is under subsidized and under researched. So, you know, people don't have the big money to buy the electric cars right now, even though they would be a good push in the right direction. Although we would still have to pay to energize those. But they know you're not. They know you, gas is it. So if you're not buying gas, you're walking. And good luck walking 30 or 40 miles to work because they've completely shut off any access to public transportation. So they know they got you. So in this scenario, they know someone's going to buy the gas. Once it hits the shore, it's going out. And it doesn't matter what the price per barrel is because you're going to pay it because you don't have a choice. So they buy and they sell, they jack the price up, and they take a nice cut for themselves. And I said, you know, it reminds me, you know, the guy I was talking to said, it reminds me of, you know, back when Hurricane Katrina hit. And the story that I had read just kind of blew my mind. The government bid out contracts to clean up the debris. So they sent out a bid. They got a bid for $47 a ton, I think it was at the time. So by the time they subcontracted it out, because the company that got the bid subcontracted to someone else who said, hey, I can do that a couple of pennies cheaper. And they subcontracted to somebody else who could do it cheaper, and so on down the line. And remarkably, the number it blew my mind for what the guy who actually picked up the trash got paid. The guy who was out there with the shovel and the truck got paid $3 a ton. $47 is what we paid. $3 is what it cost. And all along the way, every one of those people who, hey, it's good business, isn't it? Sell high, buy low. Isn't that it? So we got a high bid. We got somebody desperate enough to do it for $3. We made $44 all along the process per ton, every person. And that's what's going on with the oil. That's what's going on here. These speculators know you don't have a choice. They know if they jack it up high enough, you're going to have to pay it one way or another, which is why there should be something done with Republicans in power. Not going to happen. And understand what's going on in the free market. We see all these states who they found natural gas. Mississippi, for instance, they say they have found some natural gas in state waters. So they're going to say, go ahead, go drill, baby, drill. So these folks who are the 12 miles south coalition, they've said, maybe we should hold back. Maybe we should take a look at what's going on, because do you really want to be drilling right in the middle of the water? Do we want to do that? Understand that Mississippi has a huge tourism business. So you have a lot of people who come to their lakes and come to their rivers. It's kind of a tourist thing. Do you really want to maybe screw that up by having some kind of an accident? Who knows what? Shouldn't we take a look at this? Well, that's what this 12 miles south coalition is trying to do. They're trying to get the state to say, hey, let's hold off on this, especially since the prices of natural gas have just plummeted because there's so much availability of it. And you know where this goes. You absolutely know where it goes. This goes to the point where, hey, we need to start tearing things down. Because you remember the story I talked about the other day. They were saying they're actually cutting natural gas production across the country. Why? Well, because prices are going down. When they first started in 2008, it was $8 they could get for a unit. Now it's down to $2.50. So you know what's going to happen, and I can already hear it now. The arguments from all these states are going to say, hey, we need to cut taxes. Hey, we need to cut regulation. Oh, we need to cut those workers' wages. We need to cut benefits. We need to hand out huge tax breaks. Oh, yeah. We got to get these companies to come and drill, baby, drill. And we'll give out tax breaks and we'll lower those environmental regulations so that the people who live there have to clean up the mess when it's done. And then you know what we'll do with all of that energy that we're getting and we're being heavily subsidized for? We'll ship it overseas. Because we're not getting enough for it right now. It's only $2.50. We can maybe take it overseas and get a little more. That's where they're taking us, man. That's how this game is played. And you look at the coal industry. I talked about it yesterday. They want to ship, 1,250 coal cars full of coal from Montana to China. Got to take it right across there, out one of the ports in Washington, so they can ship it over to China. What happened to energy independent? I keep hearing people say, well, we need to produce more energy. We're producing tons of it, millions of tons of it. Where's it going? It's going overseas. Why? So the Wall Street and the speculators and the investor class can put money in their pocket. That's why. And we can keep screwing you at the pump every time you fill up. Understand, and I'll say it until I'm blue in the face, we are a net exporter of energy. It's insane. Quick break, right back after this.
I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says President Obama's budget would put America on the right path towards building a solid foundation for our economic future. The Labor Federation says the president's proposed investments in infrastructure, clean energy, manufacturing, education, and innovation will help build that economic foundation that we all need. The AFL-CIO is also praising Obama's efforts to end tax breaks for shipping jobs overseas and to beef up enforcement of trade agreements. Asking millionaires to pay more taxes at the same effective rate as working families is also a fiscal step in the right direction, according to the AFL-CIO. America, the Labor Federation says, has to decide between repeating the same mistakes that led to 2008's financial crash or learning from them and rebuilding our economy on a stronger foundation. California's South Bay Labor Council is fighting a move by the San Jose City Council to cut city worker pensions without collectively bargaining over the issue. Cindy Chavez is executive officer of the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council. She says this attack on collective bargaining and vested worker pension rights is illegal, but the city is putting the question on the ballot anyway.
This is a frontal attack on vested rights. And even though they know that this is illegal, and I believe they do know that, they're willing to put it on the ballot, and they're willing to risk the city coffers to break the unions, and meaning that this is not about the budget. This is absolutely about showing dominance and breaking the labor movement here and across the country.
Michigan state employee unions are challenging a law passed in 2011 that requires workers employed since 1997 to switch pensions to a 401k-style plan that's dependent on the stock market or stick with the current plan but contribute 4%. New employees are required to take the 401k-style plan. Five unions are jointly filing the suit on behalf of more than 30,000 state workers in Michigan. The lawsuit alleges that the new law is unconstitutional and that it needed to go through the Civil Service Commission before being enacted. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part by the United Steelworkers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Yes, wouldn't it be fun, little pink doilies and our finger up in the whole nine yards. Our tweet of the day comes from Suburb Ranch. He says, we're not just finding smoking guns these days. They're actually in the process of reloading. And, you know, he's talking about the Heartland Institute, the documents that were leaked, you know, basically laid out the plan. Go and re-educate those children. And I immediately thought of Talisman Corporation here in Pennsylvania. Talisman Terry, remember him? The friendly Fracosaurus? You know, they put out that coloring book for kids, you know, to tell them how wonderful fracking was, what a great industry it was, and how everyone was happy. Lots of smiling faces. Wonderful stuff. Anyway, here to talk to us about the Heartland Institute documents and what they were planning is Joe Rome. He's the editor of the Climate Progress blog, one of the great ones on the net. Joe, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
You know, I look at this and, you know, no surprise in my mind. I mean, it's stuff we've known. I guess it's just documents to back up what we already knew.
Yeah, well, you know, the Heartland Institute is kind of one of the smaller, hardcore global warming denier, you know, think tanks. you know, the right wing and the fossil fuel companies have set up, as I'm sure you know, just dozens and dozens of groups, all with slightly different names, all with slightly different agendas. Heartland, you know, has a key focus on spreading disinformation and attacking climate scientists. And these documents, are fundraising documents and other documents, and they just sort of reveal, the network of corporations and individuals who are funding this disinformation, and then just some of the more outrageous projects, as you mentioned, including this effort to spread, you know, falsehoods and lies to K through 12, our kids.
Well, what to me, it just solidified what I've always known is they see my kids as potential victims of their of their propaganda, and they will do everything they can possibly do to get into the schools. And I look at the Fracasaurus coloring book as just another one of those in a very long line of ways to influence my kid and to advertise to my children. I mean, I've got three small kids, and I am every day angered by what I see. This company has sponsored this, and this is brought to you by this company. My kids are more advertised to than I ever was.
Oh, I know, and I have a 5-year-old daughter myself, and you know, they soak everything in, as you know, and they'll see something and repeat it, and you know, what's particularly sad here is, you know, this dovetails with the effort to spread disinformation or bad education to our children on evolution. And, you know, science education, understanding biology and understanding physics are critical if America is going to compete. You know, in China and India and Germany, they don't spread, you know, they don't teach their kid lies. And you know, they teach their kids science, and that's who our kids are going to have to compete with when they're grown up.
Yeah, and that's what scares me, because we're spending so much time on ideology and so little time on making sure that my kid's going to have an opportunity to have a future.
Yeah, and well, that's the other point, how immoral this is, because it's bad enough that a group like the Heartland Institute is their goal is to delay action, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to, you know, promote, delay deployment of solar and wind and other clean energy long enough for the fossil fuel industry to make, you know, a few more $100 billion. But at the same time, the result is going to be a ruined climate if they get away with it, for that our kids are going to have to suffer with.
Yeah, but they figure, I got my profits, I'll be long gone by the time that happens. And by the way, we could probably, you know, buy on what's left, on what decent land is left, because they'll have all the money. But I look at this, and, you know, the question is, can we have an honest conversation at all in this country? Because it seems that, you know, no matter where you look, especially on the right wing, man, they've got all of these euphemistically named groups who are heavily funded. And to look at this, like you said, some very small, hardcore group, $6 million budget. I'm going, that is a huge budget for a small group like this.
Yeah, no, it is a lot of money, and it allows them, you know, to fund a lot of the hard, you know, the phony, the, not phony, but you find some people with a PhD in some science area, and you put them on retainer for $5,000 a month, and then you can, you know, send them to the media when the media is doing a story, and you have your balance, you know.
You can trot them out.
And instead of the media reporting that, you know, 97% of climate scientists, you know, understand that the climate is changing and humans are the cause, you get this he said, she said stuff, and that's what, you know, a key goal of these denier think tanks is, and it's all from the tobacco industry. The tobacco industry came up with this strategy in that famous memo, doubt is our product. You know, they it's much easier to spread doubt.
Yep.
Than it is, obviously, to explain, you know, complicated science to the general public in order to drive the action needed to avert, you know, disaster.
Yeah, I mean, but even if you do doubt it, I mean, even if you look, I don't know, who knows? Somebody's going to say, I don't know what it is. Doesn't common sense say, don't we err on the side of caution? And if we can reduce some of the things that we're doing, isn't that sensible? I mean, or don't we think that way anymore?
Well, you know, as you say, one political party has been captured by this extremist wing. And you know, when you ask the American people, they overwhelmingly support, you know, solar and wind. And I just did a post today that they overwhelmingly oppose subsidies to the big fossil fuel companies. But, you know, we just the way politics is, as you know, if you can't get 60 votes in the U.S. Senate, you can't accomplish anything. And that allows the well-funded minority backed by the fossil fuel industry, which Lord knows has a lot of money, to block action.
Yeah, another example of us funding our own demise. Because look, they've got us. They got us by the short hairs. Every one of us has to buy gasoline. Every one of us has to turn on we have to buy electricity, which is generally coal-fired power plants. They got us.
Well, there's no question that it's you know, certainly one of the great tragedies is that all of this money that we spend on energy, a large fraction of it is going into the hands of industries that are spend money on lobbying, and threaten 30-second ads against political opponents and fund these organizations to spread disinformation, all, as you say, you know, just to eke out a few more years of profits, you know, before the reality, I mean, that's not going to stop climate change.
Right.
And, you know, people see the staggeringly extreme weather. I mean, geez, today I just took a walk. It was in the upper 50s here in Washington, D.C. There's been no winter at all. We had, you know, two or three cold days in the past two or three months. But the media, you know, hardly talks about this at all. But it's just going to get warmer and the weather's going to get more extreme and more ice is going to melt. And we're going to get to this point where people are going to wake up and say, geez, you know, may the climate scientists were right. But, you know, by then, it's going to be awfully hard to do anything about it.
You know, what bothers me is, look, you know, we here in the state of Pennsylvania last year, they cut $1 billion from public education. They cut higher education by a huge amount. This year, they're cutting more from education, 30% from higher education. And what bothers me is you've got all of these groups who have, and this Heartland Institute thing just highlights the fact that they've got money to throw around. And with all these education cuts, you see all these desperate school districts who are saying, you know what, I need to be able to keep the lights on and keep the teachers paid and all that happening. You know, maybe I'll give in a little bit and let these crazy groups come in and poison the minds of my kids.
Yeah, well, there's no question that the schools, you know, as you said early on, they have to turn to corporations because their budgets are getting squeezed. In Pennsylvania, one has to bring up your former senator who is leading the charge on, saying this is all a hoax and attacking Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney for ever having believed in global warming.
Well, he came out with a really good one the other day, and I've been using it. He claims that energy costs are what caused the Bush collapse. It wasn't the housing market. It wasn't the mortgages, all the fraudulent activity. No. It was because people wanted to run their air conditioners and they didn't pay their mortgage.
Yeah. Well, and go figure. We had two terms of Bush and Cheney, two oil guys, Halliburton, remember, running the government, and we still had record high oil prices. So, you know, go figure.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I went to the gas pump, and it's $3.55 here. I see reports it's going to be $4 probably by May. Yet I see these reports that the U.S. is a net exporter of energy. I saw a report that in Montana they're going to be shipping like 1,250 coal cars a day out to China. The natural gas prices are plummeting. We're seeing that stuff going over to China. Why $4 a gallon? I mean, if we're a net exporter of energy, how's this helping us? How is more drill baby drill helping us?
Yeah, and the media has spread some confusion on this. I think there's three points. We are now a net exporter of refined petroleum, but we are still a net importer of oil. It's just that our refineries have been running overtime and we've been selling diesel fuel in particular, because we have become very good at making clean diesel. So we've been selling that overseas. I think the oil prices are driven, you know, look, we have incredible tensions in the Middle East right now.
Yep.
I mean, we just got through the war, you know, with Libya, whatever you want to call it, with Libya. And now, you know, there's Iran is threatening to close the Strait of Hormuz. And I think there was just the major story that speculators, you know, the minute people start talking about war in the Middle East, speculators bid up the price of oil, and I think there's no question that certainly, you know, has played a role. But I think Americans are going to have to get used to high oil prices, because, you know, in the past, oil prices would go up and Americans would scale back their use, and that conservation would lead to reduction in demand and oil prices would go back down. But now, demand in the world is driven to a large extent by developing countries like China and India. So even though Americans have scaled back oil consumption, India and China, you know, they're going to be motorizing. They're
ramping it up. Yeah, and it keeps telling me that we need to be looking for alternative energy and not more drill, baby, drill, because we can't drill our way out of it.
Well, absolutely. That's the key point. If you want to make your economy more resilient to higher oil prices, then you have to reduce the amount of oil your economy relies on. That's the only strategy. Simply getting oil, for instance, from the dirty oil in Canada in the tar sands, that doesn't make us more secure, because there's a world price for oil, and when the price doubles, it's going to hit our economy, whether it comes from Canada or the Mideast.
Well, let me ask you on that real quick. I got about 30 seconds left. You know, you said about the dirty oil coming from Canada. It's my understanding that we're not even getting that. It'll just pass right into Texas and right out into the international markets.
Well, there's no question TransCanada, the company behind the tar sands pipeline, refuses to, has said, you know, they're going to export some of that oil. I don't think there's any question. We are, as I said, we're exporting more and more of our refined petroleum. So yes, there's no question that a significant amount of that oil wouldn't even end up in this country.
Yeah, so when Rick Perry said it would have building that pipeline would help our dependence on foreign oil, it'd get us off the foreign oil, he was wrong on both counts.
Well, Canada is not the United States. I think people don't get energy security. We have a world oil market, and it is events and demand outside of this country that are now driving up oil prices. And whether you get the oil from Canada or whether you get it from overseas, when the oil price spikes, it still hurts Americans' pocketbooks exactly the same.
Yep. Joe Rome, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Joe Rome, editor of the Climate Progress blog. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Barack Obama was right on target 2 years ago when he denounced the Supreme Court for allowing unlimited corporate cash to flood into our elections, calling it a, quote, threat to democracy. But now the gushers of that money are pouring into this year's Republican presidential campaigns through super PACs. He has pivoted adroitly from condemning such corrupt funds to creating one of his own. Savvy or cynical? I call it sad, not because Obama wouldn't stand on principle, but because his switch affirms that special interest money now governs us, too powerful for even the sitting president to resist. These super PACs, all of which are creatures of a handful of rich Americans, were already the biggest power in the Republican presidential contest. Frontrunner Mitt Romney's last name is even an anagram that spells M-O-N-E-Y. And a $30 million super PAC financed chiefly by Wall Streeters has powered him to the front. They want to buy a president who'll undo Obama's financial reform law that restrains some of their greed. That's what our democracy has become. Sad. Rather than taking the high road and rallying a public that's thoroughly disgusted by this, Obama now joins Romney et al. On the money-slick low road. His super PAC, named Priorities USA, is as corrupt as the Republicans. All of them perpetuate the ludicrous legalistic fraud that the secretive funds operate independently of the candidates. Come on, hand puppets act with more independence than super PACs. While Obama piously says that he won't work directly with the PAC, he's directed cabinet officials and White House aides to rustle up big donors to fund it. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we're getting this year is not a presidential election, it's an auction. To help repeal the Supreme Court's money rule, go to unitedforthepeople.org. That's united, the number four, thepeople.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. You know, and I look at this whole energy thing. To me, it just seems so much like common sense to say, look, we get a good portion of our oil from a place that hates us. I mean, really. I mean, whether you buy the right wing's Islamo-fascist argument and all of that or not, doesn't matter to me. We've had problems with those folks. They've got something that we need, and the only reason we deal with them is because we need it. So why not, as Carter tried to do, get us off of it, wean us off what we're taking from them, at least, and stop selling what we're taking from Alaska, stop selling that overseas. Seems common sense to me. You have your own oil. You have your own energy. You have your own natural gas. You deal with your own resources. You don't give those away for profit. I mean, does it not seem... Yeah, I look at this and, you know, you go, well, you know, it's the free market. We're pushing out these free market ideas. And you go, okay, so we're going to drill resources out of our land. We're going to ship them everywhere around the world. And then we're going to end up being the ones who have to deal with the wars. I mean, if you really stop and think how much a gallon of gas cost us, can you imagine how much you would have to add in with all of the wars that we've fought, all of the nonsense and all of the ridiculous stuff that we end up getting ourselves into, just because they've got something under their sand? And yet we've got people who keep, yeah, let's keep pushing down that road. We need drill, baby, drill. You know, the Indians get it. India gets it. You know, they got to get off the stuff. In fact, they say that they're going to exceed their 2009 goal. Understand, just 3 years ago, they made a goal. They're going to produce 20,000 megawatts of solar energy. And their goal was to do that by 2020. They're going to do it in the next couple of years. What does that say about us? We have that kind of ingenuity. We have that kind of technology. We just don't have the will in politics. Because you talk to average everyday people, they tell you the same thing. Got to get off the oil. Got to get away from the trouble spots. Leave them alone. Tell them to go pound sand. But we've got a political system that set us, with all of its special interests and all its big donors who keep pushing us into this. Why? Because there's big profit to be made for the few at the top. And again, this is another one of those 1% issues. This is another one of where they at the top, they're not dealing with the price of oil. It's not destroying their budgets. They're not the ones who care about if gas prices go up a buck or two a gallon. It doesn't bother them. They're the ones benefiting from it. It's you and me. And you know where I will agree with Santorum? It hurt a lot of families. That took a lot of money out of disposable income. It took a lot of money out of education. It took a lot of money out of just putting food on the table. But to say it caused the collapse, I'm not going there with you. What caused the collapse is all of these bad these toxic mortgages, all of this just all of the speculation that rose prices so high. And I go back to when I sold my own house. They came to me with the first day and said, this is what the houses in the area are going for. Here's what we can get for it. And by the time I sold it, I ended up getting like $35,000 more for it. Because they just kept pushing people. And it was the whole system. The whole system was out of control, and it was led by the banks. The banks said the money's there. The realtors said, hey, it's there, so let's get as much as we can because we're on commission. The appraisers were in on it too, because the more houses that sell, the better commission they get, the more that they get to do. So it was this whole incestuous situation. You got the banks giving money to the realtors and all of this stuff because, hey, use our mortgage company because, you know, we can get the fees. That's what it was. Energy prices contributed. And then once the collapse happened, it was the millions of jobs that were lost and the fact that people were in over their heads because we didn't have rules on banks. And what you're seeing right now is you're seeing the big money saying, you know what, we need to go back to those days. Let's go back to the wild, wild west, even though the wild, wild west wasn't as wild and wild as they tell us. It's just one of those amazing moments where you go, well, somebody, please, somebody with an ounce of sense, say, you know what, in order to lead this country forward into the 21st century, we need to be energy independent, and that's where you stake your flag. And you say, you know what, no more drilling for oil in Alaska that we're shipping to China or Russia or anywhere else. No more shipping 1,250 rail cars a day through Washington, out through the port, to China. No more of that. We're going to keep energy at home. You want to hear the righties squeal? You want to hear them go nuts? What? There won't be any more international profits? And I know there's somebody out there saying, Rick, you just don't understand. You don't understand the free market. You don't understand global trade. Yeah, I do. I understand. I understand what happens to people like you and me. I understand what happens to the folks at the bottom globally. Not just here in the U.S., but globally. We get screwed. We're the ones who have to deal with all of the pollution and have to deal with all of the costs and all of the negative side effects from the policies that the Kochs and the others, the Bradleys and all the other foundations and the big conservative money think tanks try to ram down our throats. And what every person should be just infuriated about is that this group was going, yeah, hey, we're going to put a curriculum together for those high school science teachers. It's trickled down from buying college professors and buying onto college boards and setting up these little groups at the colleges. Now they're going into the high schools and into the grade schools. And, oh, don't forget Talisman Terry, the friendly Fracasaurus coloring book. Your kids can smile, color on the big, happy, smiling face of Terry the Fracasaurus. So that when they go to him and say, is fracking good? Little Jimmy or Johnny will go, oh, yes, fracking is wonderful. See? Talisman Terry says it's great. He's the Fracasaurus. It kind of boggles the mind. But, again, it's what we've allowed to happen. It's what we, you know, all we see is that price at the pump. Oh, that's what I'm paying today. Why can't we get off of it? Why aren't there alternatives? Because right now you want to drive a car, you got really, really one choice, and that's gas. People who've got a couple extra bucks, they go into the electric, but the technology right now is a little bit up in air. So you've got to have a couple of bucks to make sure that you can get through it. But there are no alternatives. I can't get to work. I cannot get to work without my car. I live 28 miles away. I cannot get to my place of employment without a car. And why is that? That's because we have no vision, no foresight, no idea what the future is going to be in this. We can't do light rail. We can't do high-speed rail. We can't do any of that. And why is that? Well, because the special interests have said no. You know, like I said a couple weeks ago, I was doing some research. And I came across a bunch of documents from the early 80s, you know, saying that high-speed rail was one of the priorities then. And I'll bet you if I went back to the 60s and 70s, they were still talking about it. But it was the big-moneyed special interests that kept it away from us. Because they're good at that. They're so good at it. They're so good at convincing us, well, you need this or you don't need that. You need to privatize your prisons. That's a good idea. Let's privatize the prisons. And, you know, we've been doing that here. We've been doing it across the country for years, privatizing everything. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Captain Mark Riley. He is a corrections officer down in Florida about their situation down in Florida. Yesterday, as I said, the Florida Senate voted against a bill to privatize their prisons. And we'll talk to him about that. Quick break, right back after this.
I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky ones. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Paleontologists have wondered why mammals, including humans, evolved to have larger brains than other animals.
A team of scientists now believes that large brains might have developed in mammals first in order to facilitate a good sense of smell. Results of this study appeared in May 2011 in the journal Science. The team examined rare 190 million-year-old fossil skulls of two of the earliest known mammal species, tiny, furry creatures no bigger than a paperclip.
These minuscule mammals from the Jurassic fossil beds of China had much larger brains than expected for their size. In particular, said the science team, the olfactory part of the brain, used in the sense of smell, was enlarged in these early mammals.
The scientists said this discovery wouldn't have been possible without CT scanning technology. They were able to use CT scans to peer into these tiny skulls without damaging them. Without this technology to get this result and this insight into the brains of these tiny early mammals, scientists would have had to break open these rare and precious fossil skulls.
Early mammals would have used their sense of smell to find food, find a mate, and detect physical danger. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
So yesterday we were talking about this Corrections Corporation of America and the letter that they sent out to 48 states across the country saying that they would manage their prisons for $250 million a year. And I look at this and I go, okay, we're going to pay them $250 million per year, every state, to manage these prisons. What are we going to have to give up? According to the letter, and according to the folks over at Huffington Post, all they wanted was a guarantee of at least a 90% occupation rate. They want 90% of the beds filled. So we got to keep locking people up. And as I said yesterday, we are now turning, we have turned people into commodities that can be locked up. But now we're just admitting it. Anyway, yesterday, the Florida State Senate voted 21-19 against a privatization bill. They want to privatize their prisons. They turned it back. And like we said, you know, there's a real push. That's why I've asked Captain Mike Riley, who is a prison guard down in Florida, to come talk to us. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Good
afternoon there.
Yeah, a fantastic outcome yesterday.
Yes, sir. We were quite pleased with it.
What did it take to get to that point? Because I got to be honest with you, I thought that this privatization scheme was just going to slide right on through without a whisper.
To be honest with you, we've been fighting this for 2 years. We fought with our previous union, which was the Florida Police Benevolent Association. The officers were not allowed to get very involved with it, and it was pretty much fought by the association. When the Teamsters came in and we adopted the Teamsters in and took them as our union, they got the officers involved, and we've been involved with it now for a year and a half up here with the officers speaking to the legislature and letting them know what we do every day, how important this job is to us, and the effect that it have on our families and our communities, and it seems to work.
No, I mean, anytime you can get people, which is the reason we asked you to come on the program, because I'm expecting this fight to privatize Pennsylvania's prisons to come here, much like it has in Florida. You know, given the fact that you've got this Correction Corporation of America, the largest private prison facilitator in the country, saying we'll run them all, just make sure we got enough bodies.
Yes, sir. The biggest thing that people are not seeing is when they go to comparing the private prisons, their cost to what the public prison costs, the public prison can do it cheaper. We proved that in Florida. The numbers are adjusted for political reasons, but we've proven that the public officers can do it cheaper, and the officers are better paid. You have better officers. What we ran into in Florida was the CCA hires officers that the Florida Department of Corrections has fired for incompetence or misbehavior at work. And that's the kind of staff that they're using to protect the public safety. And that's a problem.
You know, I guess another question that we should be asking is, you know, what is the role of the prison in our society? I mean, is it just a holding pen for profiteers, or is it somewhere where we attempt to actually rehabilitate and get people back into society where they're not going to go back and it's not going to cost us more money in the long run?
For years, prisons have been looked at as a place to warehouse people while they do their time. For the last several years here in Florida, we have got on a big mission for reentry to rehabilitate these inmates and prepare them to go back into society so they can become an asset to society. They'll become taxpayers. They're not a burden on society. And that's part of our job. And we're actually, we kind of take a little offense to the word guard because we're correctional officers. We don't just make sure the inmates are there. We actually help the inmates prepare to go back into society.
And that's the hope. And, you know, I don't know if this is how reality is, but sometimes on one of the cable networks at night, I watch this lock up raw from here or there. And I got to be honest with you, I wouldn't want your job. And I know very few of my friends who would want it, because it is a dangerous, job. It's a taxing job. And I can't imagine, thank you for doing it, but I can't imagine anybody wanting to.
You're going to find a lot of the officers that do it have a strong self of public service, a sense of public service, and a lot of them are actually veterans. We went in the military to serve our country. When we come out, we still feel that, you know, there should be a way we should serve our country, and this is one way for us to do that.
So in looking at this privatization scheme, because, you know, I'm going back to this Corrections Corporation of America who, you know, well, we'll take over the prisons. You just make sure you keep our 90% of our rooms full. You know, I go back to this, and I go, you know, is there any incentive if we move to a for-profit system of rehabilitating people so that they stay out? And I would have to think that there'd be a disincentive for you know, job training or education or, you know, getting their GED or drug treatment. I would have to think there would be a major disincentive for a private company to do those things.
Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, in Miami, we actually had a judge that was found guilty of sentencing people to a juvenile facility because he was getting kickbacks from the private company that was running it.
Well, I got you
and
beat.
They were actually...
I got you beat, Captain. We had two. We had two judges got caught for the exact same thing, getting kickbacks from the private, you know, juvenile detention centers here up in Scranton, you know, and giving people mandatory sentences and long sentences for really almost nothing.
Yes, sir, that's the problem. When any time you take someone's freedom and you put a price on it, is that really fair? Is that the government doing what they're supposed to be doing for our citizens?
And the answer is no. And I give you guys all the credit in the world for fighting it back. Because like I said earlier, I really, with your governor and your legislature, I never thought it possible in a million years. Kind of gives me hope that if you look here, because we're in the kind of the same situation. We've got a very conservative Republican governor and a steamroller-proof majority in the Senate and the House. I fear that when the privatization comes up here, we're not going to be able to stop it.
One thing I would encourage the officers to do up there is meet with your legislators. It was very encouraging at this hearing on the vote to actually hear the senators stand up and say that their opinions of correctional officers had changed, that they saw our professionalism, they saw the way we cared, and that did a large part into them changing their votes.
Well, I got to ask you this, because, you know, when they stand up and say, you know, we're impressed by their professionalism, what did they think you were?
They thought we were a bunch of rednecks, beer drinking, truck driving, pickup truck driving, that we just went around, beat on inmates all the time, uneducated. We couldn't get another job because we had no education.
Really? Did they tell you that? Because that's mind-blowing to me.
Some of them have actually said some along those lines.
Wow.
That they really didn't think we had the education to get other jobs. I work alongside people sometimes that have master's degrees, people that have bachelor's degrees, and they choose to go in this line of work because it's rewarding to them.
Now, God bless them. Personally, I don't think I would want to be any part of it, but I see it as something that we need as a society. I just don't think it's something that we should be profiting from. And, you know, anytime, in my opinion, you're allowing someone to profit off of someone's misfortune, I think that's a bad situation, and it's a bad thing to be pursuing. And fortunately, your Senate said no.
Yes, sir. And we're very grateful for them for that.
So I got about a minute and a half left, you know, in talking about your job, because I think most people, you know, don't know what an average day for a prison guard is. Can you lay some of the details out of what you do on an average day?
Well, we have basically two different styles of prisons. We have an open population and we have a closed management. Currently I'm working in an open population. We go in, we take the inmates to breakfast. We have anywhere from 50 to 300 inmates out at one time. We take them into a cafeteria-style setting. We have 150 inmates in there eating. We feed them breakfast. We take them back to their housing units. We come in. We count them again. The inmates go to their different programs, be it for a GED, vocational, law library, and recreation. And then we come back in. We feed them lunch. After lunch, they return to the training, vocational programs, education, and recreation area. And they stay out there till about 3:30. We bring them in. We count them again. When we take them, we feed them dinner. And then, depending on the time of the year, they either go back out for recreation or to go to religious programs that we have for them. And then we have officers that spend the night making sure that they have a safe place to sleep, that they're not being attacked by other inmates or taken advantage of.
Because this is a dangerous setting. I mean, you said anywhere from 50 to 300 inmates you're around at any time. How many of you are there? I mean, if there's 50 to 300, how many officers are there in the vicinity?
Well, for example, on the midnight to 8 shift that I'm currently supervisor of, we have 22 officers on the compound that are responsible for 1,200 inmates.
22 for 1,200.
Yes, sir.
And how many during the daytime when people are out and about?
During the daytime, that number runs up to about 31.
So at any time, you're not talking about 30. When there are 300 people walking around, there aren't just 31. There aren't 31 people with them at all times, is there?
No, sir. If, for example, in the recreation field, we may have 600 inmates out there, and you only have two or three officers. The officers, we have no weapons. We have chemical agents that we carry on our side. And we have a radio. A lot of people watch TV and they think we carry guns, we carry nightsticks. That's
no,
not true.
You wouldn't carry a gun in there because they'd take it from you and use it.
Yes, sir.
Wow. I didn't realize it was that big a difference in numbers. And in a private setting, Because this is a your prison is not privatized; it's held by the state of Florida in a private setting. How many officers would be in that scenario? Like you just laid out, you said there are 31 during the day, 22 at night in a private setting. How many do you think there would be?
Well, the easiest way I can explain it to you is the biggest expense in running a prison is in your personnel. So if they're going to reduce it by whatever they're saying they're going to reduce the cost by, then that means they're going to have to reduce the personnel. So you can figure that at least a third of the officers would be missing. So we would be looking on day shift when most of the inmates are out. You might have 25, 26 officers. At night, you'd be running with 19 or 20.
Wow. Yeah, no thanks. Again, thank you for the job you do. I wouldn't want to do it, which is why, I go back to this. We shouldn't be allowing companies, investors, the Romneys of the world to benefit off of this. Captain Mike Riley, I appreciate the time, and I appreciate the work you do.
Thank you, sir.
Let's take a quick break with your calls right after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
On December 28, 1970, President Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act into law. Thanks to strong lobbying efforts by union leaders over many years, this safety bill of rights established for the first time a comprehensive national policy to protect workers' health and safety. Effective April 28, 1971, employers were required to provide a workplace free of known hazards that caused or were likely to cause serious physical injury or death. Prior to the passage of OSHA, work-related injuries and deaths were extremely high. The 1920s saw reports of 20,000 workers killed on the job and more than 2.5 million injured per year. That number remained until the 1960s when work-related deaths dropped to 14,000 per year, but injuries increased by 20%. Today, thanks to OSHA, protections on-the-job injuries have fallen 40% and on-the-job deaths have been reduced by 60% pre-OSHA. OSHA is considered the first piece of legislation allowing the government to inspect and hold employers accountable for dangerous and physically harmful working conditions. OSHA has three branches, an enforcement branch, a research branch, and a review branch. Since its passage, OSHA has allowed for greater visibility and oversight in conditions on the job, prioritizing efforts to prevent accidents, control health hazards, and ensure workers go home as safe and as healthy as when they arrived on the job. While OSHA is a step in the right direction, there is still considerable work to be done, and only through the eyes and voices of working people with the help of their unions will tomorrow be a safer day. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
What you can call me is not a prison guard. No way in a cold day. You're telling me at night you're looking at 54 inmates for every one of the officers there, and during the daytime almost 39-1? Really? Wow. Never in a million years. Anyway, the ACLU of Pennsylvania has come out with a report showing that all 57 county prisons here in the state of Pennsylvania, they fail to meet just the basic legal standards for health care for women. And again, it's more of that, you know, women have kind of fallen through the cracks, especially in the penal system. They're saying that nationally, the rate of incarcerated women has gone up by 11.2%. That's twice the rate of men. So I guess women are doing their best to catch up. But, you know, you look at the reality, there are some 3,800 women in county jails across the state, and the numbers that I've seen are pretty horrible. 11 counties had no written policies on how to take care of a pregnant woman. None. 10 of the counties had no policy for testing for pregnancy. So they could have inmates in there who, you know, maybe me coming in pregnant, have no idea. And a lot of the, you know, the gynecological stuff, not just, wow. And again, it comes back down to this, you know, how much can we cut, gut, and punish? How much can we take out? How much can we steal away? Anyway, today, back in 1934, U.S. legislators passed the Civil Works Emergency Relief Act, provided funds for the Federal Emergency Relief Administration. That funneled money to the states. As you remember, we were in a depression back then, so we had to get, you know, the states some money to help with their poverty programs, help with unemployment, and it also saw with the oversaw the substantial distribution and relief efforts. Today, the legislature did that. I don't think we could get something like that passed today. You stop and you think about the political divide. We're still not fully recovered. We're still struggling. The economy's coming back slowly. But you look at the folks on the right, they would never give that kind of a victory to get money back into the hands of the states so that they could deal with their unemployment, their poverty programs. No, they're actually quite happy that the Corbetts and the Walkers and all of the other people across the country are cut, gut, and punish, are slashing education programs, slashing public service programs, because it's slowing the economy down. It's holding us back. And I look at the Obama budget, who, you know, the Republicans have said it's dead on arrival and it's never going to pass. But what it shows me is it shows me that he's at least thinking a little bit forward, saying that, hey, you know, we should be building infrastructure. We need it. And in fact, the budget included $350 billion in short-term measures just to grow the economy. Things like an infrastructure investment bank, to get projects going, rebuild schools, all kinds of things designed to get the economy moving. And how are you going to pay for it? Well, enact the Buffett rule. Get rid of the Bush tax handouts for the very wealthy. You know, we could really start to bring our deficits down. But the right's not going to let that happen. The conservatives are not going to let it happen. And there are so many things we could be doing on the revenue side that we haven't. Like here in Pennsylvania, quite simply, the impact fee that they've put is pathetic. The fact that we still have the Delaware loophole wide open is criminal. There was some talk maybe we could get that closed up. I'm sure the big money has come in, flooded in, and said, rethink that. But the reality is we should be looking at how do we raise some revenue? How do we get the economy moving again? You know, Wall Street's sitting on a couple of $1 trillion that we gave them. And they keep talking about, oh, what we need to do is we need to cut taxes again. We need more tax cuts. Tax cuts for who? The people who got them all already and didn't do what we wanted them to do with it? Like spend it? You know, we were told if we give the wealthy all the money, if we give them all that they could want, lower the tax rate down from 91% down to 70, down to 50, down to 28, back up to 35 for a little bit, but also added a bunch of loopholes that they would create jobs because that's what they do. They're job creators, and it's the uncertainty. Yeah, I keep hearing that, it's uncertainty. What's uncertain? Nothing's going to get accomplished in Congress. Nothing. And I can guarantee, even if the president wins, and I think he's going to in November, I don't know that the Democrats hold the Senate. Even if they take the House, is it going to matter? You still have divided government. And even if the Democrats win the House, you still need 60 votes in the Senate, and that ain't going to happen. So what you've got is you've got gridlock. So the certainty is nothing's going to change. That's the certainty. The certainty is as it will be, because they cannot agree on anything. And the things that they do agree on, you know, kind of scare me, like these trade agreements. But the budget, nothing. Because Obama wants to eliminate 12 tax breaks for the oil and gas and the coal companies. They claim it's going to save $41 billion over 10 years. The Republicans want no part of that. Obama wants to give $30 billion to the states to help stop the hemorrhaging of teacher jobs and firefighters and policemen and corrections officers, all of that. $30 billion to help stop that. Republicans want no part of that. And you go back and you look at all of this stuff and you go, at what point do we just not wake up and say, enough with the Republicans, enough with the bad ideas? Because you can't do both. It's impossible to have the free market ideology where just let it bottom out and it will rise back up. And, oh, we need to help poor people so that they don't bounce off the pavement. You can't have both. So this November, it has to come down to us deciding. And it's the electorate's fault that we have this problem. You need to go to the polls and you need to decide one way or another, which way are we going as a nation? Do we follow the Romney worldview, which is, you know, let it all collapse, and then out of it, you know, the investors will come in and swoop everything up, and everything will start to rise up again until they collapse it again, and we go through this all over again. Because that's the conservative worldview. Boom, bust. We create these nice big bubbles, a couple people get really, really wealthy, and everybody else gets screwed. The housing bubble, perfect example. The education bubble that's coming, another perfect example. Who's going to benefit from this? The only difference is that you can't take an education away from somebody. So when that bubble bursts, you can't take the education away from them. But you're going to have a serious problem of an entire generation who is heavily saddled with massive debt. Not to mention they're going to have to take care of their parents. We've allowed them to put us in a situation where we're screwed. I mean, they have shrunk the revenue coming into the coffers by giving us this nonsense. We'll just lower the rate and we'll cut those loopholes. See, we're cutting loopholes. See how nice we are? See how much we believe in the country? We're going to cut loopholes. But every time we lower the rate, which we've been doing since the 60s, we lower the rate, we cut out the loopholes, and what happens? The next day, you got a congressman, you got a senator, you got a president saying, well, we need to have this tax incentive to help this corporation or this industry or this sector or this person. We need to have that loophole. So now you got the lower rate, and again, you're starting to do the whole thing back down. And this is by design. They have done a masterful job of conning us into this. I'm of the mindset of saying, you know what? We should have a higher tax rate. And what we should be doing is then incentivizing. You want to do good things? We want you to do good things too. But it's going to cost. I mean, it's pretty simple. And you look at the numbers. The numbers are what they are. Rick Santorum is now, this is how crazy we are as a country. Santorum is now rising up to the top of the Republican ticket. He, with the insanity, is now going to be could be the top guy for the Republicans. I seriously doubt it, but it's possible. And you look at the latest poll that has come out by New York Times, CBS. People are now starting to look at Obama a little differently. He now has a 50% approval rating compared to Congress's 10% rating. People are starting to look at the economy in a little bit better light. Hopefully that helps. Also in that poll, which I found quite interesting, 65% of the people polled supported Obama's contraception rule. 65%. Also in that poll, 44% of Catholics said they favored marriage equality, 25% preferred civil unions, just 24% favored no legal recognition at all. The Catholic Church has got to be absolutely losing their ever-loving minds because their parishioners have gone completely against what it is they've been railing about. What do you do? Well, what you do is you turn around, you use the government against them, make them, force them. Use the power of the gun, since you can't convince them. It's quite interesting. Anyway, as I said earlier, the big money, they're betting on Romney. The big money wants to go back to the good old Bush years, where it was the wild, wild west for the banks. Basically do anything they want and make the banks gambling houses. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Alexis Goldstein from Occupy the SEC about their 325-page. So the question I guess I have is how do we make sure we don't have September of 2008 ever happen again? And is Dodd-Frank the right answer, or do we need something more?
I think that Dodd-Frank is a really good start, and part of the problem is you might have Dodd-Frank in effect, but we need people to actually act on it. So the Volcker Rule is meant to be an insurance policy against future bailouts. So the idea is no more prop trading, no more banks owning hedge funds, and that was the riskiest stuff that really led to that crash in 2008. So I do think that we're the SEC and the Fed and all the other agencies to take to heart some of the things that we suggest in the letter about closing the loopholes and really making it a strong Volcker Rule. It would really change the landscape of banking. It would make banking more boring again. And just to shout out, I guess, one other thing about Dodd-Frank that's really great, and I can't quote you the section number off the top of my head, but there's a power that has been given to the Fed to allow them to break up any bank that they see as systemically risky and too big to fail. And Public Citizen actually filed a petition to the Fed saying, you should break up Bank of America because we think that they're a risky institution. And I haven't really seen anything from the Fed since that petition, but I think Dodd-Frank is good. The question is, will they use the powers that Dodd-Frank gives them?
That's another question. And, you know, as I've been telling people for the longest time, if you've got money in Bank of America or any of the too big to fail banks, get it out. Go to a small local bank, a community bank, a credit union, better yet, because if they're not going to do it, if Washington's not going to do it, maybe we should try.
Yeah, the Move Your Money campaign, I think, was very successful last year, and I hope if people didn't move their money last year, that's something that maybe people can look into now.
So one of the things you said is that, you know, one of the causes that led to the collapse was the prop trading and some of the other things that they got away with. You know, and I hear the righties talking about, well, it was those poor black people who bought houses. It was the Community Redevelopment Act. It was making those big banks, it was forcing them to give those poor people loans. That's
so disingenuous, right? I mean, so much predatory lending happened, and a lot of the people that were targeted were people who were either recent immigrants or didn't have a huge amount of credit history. Because in order to structure some of these products and get the ratings that they got, they needed people with a very specific range of credit scores. And it just so happened that recent immigrants didn't have enough credit history to sort of have maybe bad credit, but they had enough to have sort of good credit. So, like, they were apparently the prime candidate for a lot of these loans. And it was just sort of this giant machine, right? Wall Street wanted to keep generating more products so they could keep selling it because they were making so much money on it. And so once you run out of loans, you need more loans to keep feeding the machine. So this idea that our economy was bankrupted by people being irresponsible in their loans. So many of these loans that were made were predatory. And why is it that it's only individuals that have to be liable for the mistakes that we make? And, you know, we can't. I find it disingenuous, that line of reasoning.
I absolutely agree with you. But I have a listener who's a career banker, you know, a retired banker. And he said, you know, the reality is what happened is the banking industry changed the way they thought about loans. And when he said when he was in the banking business, they looked at, did you have the ability to pay? And then they changed to not your ability to pay, but how much was the value of the asset that you were trying to buy? Because they said they knew. They'd get it back in a couple of years. You'd paid all the interest up front, and they still got the asset back. It was a win-win for them. And you got this person got to have a house for a couple of years, and then they got booted to the street. And that was the mentality.
Well, and I think another thing, and I think that's a great point, and another thing is, like you were saying, they used to have to hold the loans, but with this whole, it's called securitization, but securitization is just when you take something that wasn't tradable and you turn it into something that you can trade. So when you securitize a mortgage, you turn it into something that you can buy and sell and trade with somebody. So if you don't want to sit with this loan on your books, you can securitize it and you pass it off to this sort of shadowy special purpose vehicle. And that's what they did over and over and over again.
Has that stopped?
No. Well, it certainly absolutely slowed down because it was so unprofitable. But last I saw, we have seen it come back a bit, especially in Europe.
And does Dodd-Frank do anything to try and pull back on that? Because, you know, I'm a big fan of, you know, boring old banks that give me mortgage loans and hold my savings account and car loans and that stuff. And then, you know, if I want to invest and gamble on Wall Street, you know, there should be a gambling house. You know, any casino will do, but they should be separate. There's no way should they be commingling their resources.
There is a bit in Dodd-Frank about this specifically. It's in a different section. And there is a bit about this actually in the Volcker Rule. There's a part that says you can still do a bit of this. It's called loan securitization, but there's limits on what they can do. And it's pretty strict, but in our opinion, it's not strict enough. So we made some suggestions about how to make it stricter so that it only was talking about securitizing really boring loans like car leases and not these really complex CDO squares that were made up of thousands and thousands of mortgages split up into different tranches.
Yeah, I remember Alan Greenspan saying about derivatives that, you know, it was too complex of an instrument for the government to oversee. And it appears that it was too complex of an instrument for them to be playing with.
Yes.
So last question I've got for you, you know, in looking at this this letter, how did you get involved in doing this? I mean, this is complex stuff that, you know, most people don't want to take on, let alone write 325-page letter to the SEC over.
Right. Well, so there's a couple answers to that. My personal answer is I used to work on Wall Street, and I quit my job a couple years ago. But I felt that this was one of the best ways to use my technical expertise in a positive way. But I also think that there are people in our group that don't have that background and are just very careful, patient readers, and we're just committed to this idea of there is this open comment period. Anyone can weigh in. Let's have a voice that's not the banking lobby's voice talking about this. So it certainly takes a level of commitment, right? It's not the most fun you'll ever have on a Saturday night sitting and reading through legalese. But I also think that whatever people's particular passion is, whether it's financial regulation or maybe environmental regulation, this open comment period exists for any kind of regulation. So as long as you have the time and commitment to just trudge on through it, it's actually a really worthwhile thing to do.
Well, I appreciate the work you guys are doing. Really, I mean, the commitment. Thank you so much. And if you want to read a copy of the letter, where could we go to get it?
You can go to occupythesec.org.
And we'll get a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Alexis Goldstein's name. It'll take you right there. Alexis, I appreciate the time. Thank you for the information, and keep up the great work.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Barack Obama was right on target 2 years ago when he denounced the Supreme Court for allowing unlimited corporate cash to flood into our elections, calling it a, quote, threat to democracy. But now the gushers of that money are pouring into this year's Republican presidential campaigns through super PACs. He has pivoted adroitly from condemning such corrupt funds to creating one of his own. Savvy or cynical? I call it sad. Not because Obama wouldn't stand on principle, but because his switch affirms that special interest money now governs us, too powerful for even the sitting president to resist. These super PACs, all of which are creatures of a handful of rich Americans, were already the biggest power in the Republican presidential contest. Frontrunner Mitt Romney's last name is even an anagram that spells M-O-N-E-Y. And a $30 million super PAC financed chiefly by Wall Streeters has powered him to the front. They want to buy a president who'll undo Obama's financial reform law that restrains some of their greed. That's what our democracy has become. Sad. Rather than taking the high road and rallying a public that's thoroughly disgusted by this, Obama now joins Romney et al. On the money-slick low road. His super PAC, named Priorities USA, is as corrupt as the Republicans. All of them perpetuate the ludicrous legalistic fraud that the secretive funds operate independently of the candidates. Come on, hand puppets act with more independence than super PACs. While Obama piously says that he won't work directly with a PAC, he's directed cabinet officials and White House aides to rustle up big donors to fund it. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we're getting this year is not a presidential election, it's an auction. To help repeal the Supreme Court's money rule, go to unitedforthepeople.org. That's united, the number four, thepeople.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I'm breaking rocks in the news.
you know, it looks like in Michigan, former Representative Pete Hoekstra. Remember him? Remember him with the ad with the Chinese girl on the bike saying, oh, thank you, Debbie, spend it not, spend it now. Well, here it is. Love the music.
Thank you, Michigan Senator Debbie Spend It Now. Debbie spends so much American money, you borrow more and more from us. Your economy get very weak. Ours get very good. We take your jobs. Thank you, Debbie Spend It Now.
I think this race for U.S. Senate is between Debbie Spend It Now and Pete Spend It Not. I'm Pete Spend It Not Hoekstra, and I approve this message.
Well, evidently the voters of Michigan not approving. like I said, he ran that during the Super Bowl in Michigan. 54% of the people who have seen the ad said not going to vote for him. 45% say they're less likely to vote for him. So you got 54% saying, well, you know, not going to vote for him. 45%, probably not. Stabenow right now has a 14-point lead in the race. She has doubled her lead since the ad. So there you go. And I think more than just the racial overtones and the obnoxious nature of it, I think what the people of Michigan get is he's saying, I'm not going to spend any money. That means I'm not going to invest. I'm not going to build roads and bridges. I'm not going to do any of this stuff. And at some point, the American people have to understand that if we're not spending any money, we're not investing. And if we're not investing in the future, this nation is screwed. And I think you're seeing that in the numbers because poll after poll, there's no real enthusiasm in any of the Republican candidates. CNN Orca International poll says they found little enthusiasm for Romney or Santorum. In fact, the enthusiasm gap 34 to 32 was the race, and people just saying, no, I'm not all that really interested. Other polls I've seen have put Romney as the inevitable candidate, but people going, I don't really think, not really liking him. The more we find out about him, the more not thrilled. And as you look through the numbers, it's really kind of good for Obama. I mean, Obama's got to be happy, smiling ear to ear because they have really put themselves into a box. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're not looking forward. They're not looking to the future. They're saying, how can we cut and punish now? It's kind of scary. Also, Santorum getting some, now that he's one of the front runner, now the media is going to be sniping at his heels. Evidently, he hasn't returned he hasn't put out his tax returns yet. And if you remember the big brouhaha about Romney not putting out his, and then when he did, we find out he's got money in the Cayman Islands, he pays 13.9% tax on millions. People, you know, and that's going to keep coming up. You're going to hear about it again. But, you know, they went to Santorum, when are you going to release yours? Well, I guess back on February 9th, he said, pretty soon. Then he said, well, a couple of days. Well, here we are, a couple of days, nothing. So he says, well, you know, I actually had to go to an accountant to make sure that I had all the papers where they were supposed to be. That's kind of like saying, well, I had to have somebody do my homework for me because not going to do it. Then he said, well, you know, I can't because, I don't have – they're on my home computer, and I'm not at home. So when I get home, I can do them when I get home. I'll do my taxes when I go home. And I go, really? I mean, you can get software. There's stuff out there where you can access your computer from somewhere else. I know. My producer has it. It's one of those things you can do. It's pretty amazing. That's a little light for me. He's not in the same world with Romney, nowhere near. His FEC filings show him with a net worth between $1 and $3 million. So, he's not lighting up the world, but still, I mean, if you're going to attack somebody, you at least gotta bone up on your own. Newt Gingrich is out with an ad warning that there's an 80-year drift to the left. It's an 80-year drift to the left. All of those liberal things like Citizens United, all that liberal stuff, 80 years going to the left. And with the conservative court we've got, I mean, I don't know how you make that claim with a straight face. And, you know, I would argue that the nation, well, the courts anyway, and the politics, the politicos have moved to the right. The courts have moved decidedly to the right. The politics have moved to the right, or at least, you know, into the pockets of the big special interests. And I saw this quote by Virginia delegate Bob Marshall. He was talking about the Obamacare, and he said the government's individual mandate is not a regulation of commerce. He said it's a compelled societal duty. And this is the kicker. Indeed, the individual mandate is not voluntary commercial intercourse. He says it's forcible economic rape. I'm going, wow, that's pretty strong language. The Republicans really hate personal responsibility. They really hate the individual mandate. But it was their idea, Rick. Don't you remember? Don't you remember Hillary Care back in the 90s? When they came up with, when the Heritage Foundation, nonetheless, the American Enterprise Institute, came out and said, you know what? We need to have an individual mandate. And all the Republicans got on board. And it was kind of one of the things that took Hillary Care down, because it didn't have an individual mandate. Now they're dead set against it. And, you know, the more I look at this, I go, I'm confused. So Gingrich is saying we've moved way to the left, but in the 90s, Republicans and conservatives were dead set against Hillary Care because it didn't have personal responsibility, didn't have an individual mandate, and Democrats were just completely against it. No, no, can't have this. Now the Republicans are dead set against it because we believe in the free, free market. You should pay or die. And now Democrats who resisted it are the defenders of it. I'm kind of confused. It's one of those things that, well, it is kind of confusing. And now what you've got is the Heritage Foundation, who is where, you know, kind of where it was founded, going to really pained lengths to say, oh, well, you know, we supported it, but that was back then. Really? And you look at the op-ed written in USA Today with the headline, "Don't Blame Heritage for Obamacare Mandate." You go, wait a minute, it was your idea. Your idea was the individual mandate. In fact, the one guy who you got to kind of give him credit for, Mark Pauly's his name. He's a professor of healthcare management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He was one of the co-authors of the 1991 paper calling for this individual mandate. And he said that he was discouraged to see so many Republicans shunning the idea that they had once supported. And, you know, at the end of this, I really don't believe this had anything to do with health care or anything to do with the individual mandate or any of that. This was just pure team sport politics. And we see this a lot out of the Republicans. Actually, both sides, but more so the Republicans, because they're the ones who have taken deep, firm, entrenched positions time and time again. And then you turn around and go, oh, well, I guess they changed their mind on that one. I mean, how many times have they changed their mind? And I guess we have amnesia and we seem to forget. You know, I'm not a huge fan of Obamacare. I think it's a step in the right direction. I think it's the first step. I think it's a baby step. I think there's so much more that needs to be done. But on a certain level, the individual mandate makes sense to me. I want everybody paying into the system because I know what happens if you don't have that. The very wealthy walk away. And then the rest of us get stuck with either a very subpar healthcare system for us, or we're the ones heavily taxed over. So that's what worries me. When you have a system where you're, I think everybody should have the same health insurance. I think we should all have the same access. Oh, you're talking socialism. Well, what happened to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness? What happened to life? Should I not have the same access? Oh, well, only if you can pay for it. Pay or die. Pay or die. You know, you gotta love that. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We want the world and we want it now. Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Paleontologists have wondered why mammals, including humans, evolved to have larger brains than other animals.
A team of scientists now believes that large brains might have developed in mammals first in order to facilitate a good sense of smell. Results of this study appeared in May 2011 in the journal Science. The team examined rare 190 million year old fossil skulls of two of the earliest known mammal species, tiny, furry creatures no bigger than a paperclip.
These minuscule mammals from the Jurassic fossil beds of China had much larger brains than expected for their size. In particular, said the science team, the olfactory part of the brain used in the sense of smell was enlarged in these early mammals.
The scientists said this discovery wouldn't have been possible without CT scanning technology. They were able to use CT scans to peer into these tiny skulls without damaging them. Without this technology to get this result and this insight into the brains of these tiny early mammals, scientists would have had to break open these rare and precious fossil skulls.
Early mammals would have used their sense of smell to find food, find a mate, and detect physical danger. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at EarthSky.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Well, it looks like the Pentagon wants a new bomber. The Pentagon wants production of the Air Force's new bomber to be put on a fast track, despite the program's $550 million per plane price tag. I guess we need a stealth bomber to carry nuclear weapons. And I got to be honest, I thought we had a stealth bomber. I don't know. Anyway, I've got Ellen Ratner on the line, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you very much.
You know, I look at this, another big bomber, a stealth bomber, carries nuclear weapons. I guess we need more stealth bomber to carry more nuclear weapons.
Well, you know, the president proposed, as the START treaty, I think, had gotten down to about 1,500 nuclear weapons, 1,550 to be exact. And Trent Franks now, Republican from Arizona, said he's very concerned about the United States lowering our nuclear arsenal. We have about 1,800. He's worried that we're going to get down to past 1,000. Now, if, you know, you can get 1,000 nuclear weapons and even 500 were somehow taken out by something or other, can you imagine that you're still going to have 500 that are totally capable of wiping out humanity?
Yeah, again, you know, all of this talk about we need more efficient killing tools. Why don't we find out things on how to save people's lives?
Right.
Or feed them. There's a better idea. How about we start feeding people, healthcare, education, instead of, I don't know. You know, again, you know, how many times do we need to be able to blow up the planet?
Not 1,000 times, I don't think.
Because I think you only need to do it once, right?
Exactly.
Once it's done, it's one of those jobs that, well, congratulations, you finished it off. And before we do that, our roads and bridges need help. Will there be a vote on the transportation bill?
No vote on the transportation bill until after the recess. But there will be a vote on this conference bill, basically payroll tax. It will last for 10 months. Getting rid of past the next election, the doctor fix for Medicare, which is taking money from preventative health care, and extending the unemployment benefit, and they're going to be taking that from the federal employees' retirement.
Well, that's good. I mean, at least we
I
know
you would really
Yeah,
that would, that you would really approve of that.
Oh, I'm all in favor of it. In fact, the doc fix thing sounds really dumb to me. We're going to pay them now so that we don't take care of people who may get sick later. It seems, what kind of problems are we leaving down the line? And this thing's screwing the federal employees. Are they the permanent whipping boy?
I guess so. I mean, what it means, they said, no, we're not taking from their retirement. What they just have to do is pay in more.
You mean after we've frozen their pay for, 3 years now?
Yeah.
And they want to freeze for 5 more into the future? Just so we're getting that right.
That's what they're saying. You got it. You're figuring it out.
I think I figured it out. Never mind. Terrestrial, I can't get myself into trouble. Speaking of getting in trouble on radio.
Yeah. This isn't internet radio, huh?
No. The FCC has some new rules, speaking of the FCC.
Speaking of the FCC, they're big time right now on to this issue of what they're going to do with these robocalls. Now, the robocalls are saying basically you have to opt into the robocalls, et cetera. Makes a lot of sense, right? Except for the fact, with these robocalls, that it does not take out political, calls.
Not. We want.
And I don't, so, that you're not going to be able to get rid of.
So what is a political ad then? I mean,
it's
all
a robocall, but.
No, I understand this.
It's not, the FCC is not issuing rules about that.
You know, I understand about, is a political ad something run by one of these super PACs, or is it by a candidate? How are they differentiated?
Well, somewhere? I think it's not selling a product.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Right. So then I think that's how they're doing it.
How many robocalls for selling product? I don't think I've ever gotten one. Then again, as soon as I hear a recording, I hang up.
Yeah, so, I do too. So most people do, I think.
It doesn't really matter to me. And that's why I don't think they're effective, but do what you got to do.
Somebody must get something of them.
Yeah, the guy who
maybe the little old ladies, they get called and they listen to them.
You know what I would like to see with all of this, and this is kind of off topic, with all of this voter suppression legislation going on around the country, because we've got to have granny who has to have an ID. How about we do something about those robocalls that, we just thought, the elections were on Wednesday this year, and we told Granny that it was next week or...
Well, actually, the Federal Election Commission is really coming down pretty hard on that kind of stuff.
As they should. And I'm all in favor of public floggings. So, speaking of public floggings, a budget hearing today?
There was a hefty budget hearing today. It was run by Representative Paul Ryan, and the United States Budget Director was I thought he was quite feisty. I thought he did a pretty good job on that one. But they were really after him on a lot of ways. The Republicans said that the budget director was using talking points, and the Republicans wanted specifics. And he said that the White House was using meaningless language such as stabilize our debt and sustainable deficits. And then Debbie Wasserman Schultz got up and she said, well, for every new dollar in revenue, they had cut $2.50 in spending, and the president's budget took out the $30 billion in subsidies for the oil companies.
There's a couple of good specifics, especially the oil company money. They don't need it. They're doing better than they've ever done. I was reading a couple of stories about Geithner, who was in front of the House Ways and Means Committee, and evidently he got a little feisty too.
Well, I actually didn't go to that one, so you're up on that, and I'm not.
No, I'm just saying. I mean, it's about time that these guys just say, enough's enough already, and stop being punching bags.
Right.
And lastly, the president was in Milwaukee. Was he standing hand in hand with Scott Walker? Because I got to be honest, if I were in Wisconsin with Walker, I wouldn't want to stand near him.
Yeah, well, no. He Walker did apparently meet the plane, but basically the president delivered his thing about jobs, and that's where it went.
And something we need to be talking more about. And it's kind of interesting, though, that, I mean, the Chinese come to town. We have the whole little state dinner thing and all the happy-feely, huggy stuff and photo ops. And the president goes and says, hey, we need to start bringing jobs back from places like China. I like it.
Yeah. Why not? He said people have to insource.
I'm tired of that word. Bring jobs back where they belong, back where they were. Where
no, he said insource, not outsource. Insource.
Yeah, I know. Or resource, I've heard.
Ah, okay.
Another new bit of language. Well, good news. Ellen, I appreciate the time. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Look, you know, when you start talking about bringing jobs back, all in favor of it. And if, you know, I listened to some of the speech today, and this is going to be the campaign spiel. We need to invest here. We need to bring companies back. We need to make sure that we have the ability, get people back to work. And I was talking to a guy down earlier today, retired guy, and he said, you know, I remember, you know, back in the 60s and the 70s, when all of the flood of cheap Taiwanese at the time and Japanese products started coming into the U.S., and he said you would see these, you know, these guys who had good-paying union jobs were making good wages, going to the hardware store buying nails made in Taiwan or buying whatever. You know, I remember as a kid seeing guys working at the Ford and Chevy plants driving Datsuns, and you go, at what point did you not realize that you were screwing yourself? I mean, we as a nation have to start thinking about our purchases. If you buy, I mean, the president was at the place that makes master locks. And you go to the lock store, you know they're making master locks here in the U.S. Are you gonna pay the extra 20 or 30 cents to buy the master lock over the whatever, you know, Beijing lock that's next to it? Sadly, most people go, whatever's cheapest. And we don't think about the ramifications, the whole process. Because the job you may be saying may be your own. And I remember hearing one of the testimonies, and I forget where it was, but the guy was talking about in Oakland, California, they had built a big bridge. And this is what the congressman was saying. And that the steel was so defective, and you know they had to send it back. And then they had to send people over to inspect it. And they had to have, you know, quality control people over to make sure it was done right. And his turnaround statement was, well, we need to be able to compete with them so that we can produce as cheaply as they can. And my immediate thought was, what do you mean cheap? They sent the product, we sent it back, they had to redo it again, and we paid for it. Explain how that's cheap. You know, it's like a lot of things I buy. You know, I buy a glass or I buy a pair of pants or a pair of shoes. Yeah, they were cheap, but they didn't last me very long. We've become a very throwaway society because we got a bunch of cheap stuff. I went to the Walmart or the big box store, and I got a whole cart full of cheap plastic crap from China for $50. And then you wonder, you know, why is the garbage man charging me twice as much to remove my trash? Because I keep throwing stuff out. Sad, sad, sad. So no vote on the transportation bill. That's disheartening. Because here again, another way of getting people back to work stalled again. And for another week, now for two, because next week they're going to be out on vacation. Or, I'm sorry, recess. It's like we're in kindergarten again. They're out on recess. Oh, just can't get it done, can they? Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized, and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8-hour 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80 80,000 workers turned out to support the eight-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, eight innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. Four of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. As always, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So Herman Cain turned down Dancing with the Stars. I'd like to see the Pizza Man. I'd like to see Mr. 909 out there dancing. Maybe there was part of me that thought, well, he turned it down because he didn't want to get caught for sexual harassment again. You know, maybe while dancing, never mind. Not going there again. Not going there. Also, Michelle Bachmann has said that she's not going to join the next cast of Dancing with the Stars. She said, in full disclosure, I did win a polka dancing competition once when I was in 10th grade at my alma mater, Annook High School in Minnesota. She went on to say that, but despite my 10th grade polka success and my lifelong love of ballroom dancing, the recent rumors are false. I will not be joining Dancing with the Stars. Would have been funny to watch that Bachmann and the Pizza Man and Cheesy Dwarf. That would have been interesting. This should drive the righties absolutely ballistic because they already hate Oliver Stone to begin with. Turns out his son, Sean, who they're saying is a filmmaker, he evidently is over there making a documentary in Iran where he has, well, converted to Islam. He said the conversion to Islam is not abandoning Christianity or Judaism, but I was born with, which I was born with. It means I've accepted Muhammad and other prophets. So that should drive the right-wing crazy people absolutely nuts. And I guess that falls under the, I really don't care. I don't. I don't care what some rich kid does. Got him into the headlines. Good for him. Also under the I really not really all that concerned, I don't really care category, State Senator Eric Adams of New York, he represents the Brooklyn area. He's all fumed because Senate Republicans in New York won't allow him to bring up a resolution honoring Whitney Houston. They've said, well, she's not really from New York, and, well, you know, she was a drug addict. She died of drugs, so we can't honor her. And he's like, well, you know what? She did do a re-release of her her Star Spangled Banner, and all of the proceeds that she got went to the 9/11 victims. Evidently, that's not helping. So I don't know however you feel about that. I really don't care. It's a sad, sad tale of talent lost. All because she got hooked up with, well, in my opinion, the wrong idiot. And another one of those things where I go, I hope my kids don't make those bad choices. I really don't. And also in looking at the war on women that continues, Chuck Grassley and a number of other conservatives, they're not going to allow the vote on the Violence Against Women Act to go forward. But you may remember back in 1994, Congress passed the Violence Against Women Act, and it's been reauthorized, I think, twice since then. You know, not a problem. It comes up, it's voted on, it's done. Moved ahead. Evidently, this year, the radical right They want to beat up on gay people. So now this can't go through because there is some language forbidding discrimination against people for gender identity or sexual orientation, which is really just made them nuts. And also the reauthorization expands the availability of visas for undocumented immigrants who have been victims of domestic violence. And, boy, you want to get the righties all nuts? Talk about immigration. Kind of reminds me of New Hampshire, though. Remember I talked about the changes up there where the Republicans wanted to make a law that if cops went to a domestic violence call and they saw they saw a woman all beaten up and bloody and battered, and the guy's knuckles are all cut up and bloody, and the house is all torn apart, and he's completely, untouched. They can't arrest him because they didn't see it. They can only arrest things that they see. So basically what anybody knows is the cops would come, they would try and calm the situation down, they would leave, and it would be round two. Which I guess, there's part of me that goes, maybe the guy who proposed it, maybe he was a wife beater. And maybe a cop came in and stopped it, and that's what he's ticked off about. That's the only thing I can come up with. Nothing more there. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, the best place to go to get it. Today we talked with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, about the prevailing wage. Again, no job creation, only destroying the jobs that we have. That's the Republican focus. Talked about that. Talked about the shift that we've seen of anti-poverty programs, helping people who were middle income because of the recession, because of the Bush collapse. We also talked to Joe Rome, the editor of the Climate Progress blog over at Think Progress, about the Heartland Institute's released documents that, no surprise, they got money from the billionaire class, and they're trying to influence my kids by having curriculum that goes into the schools. But it's stuff we already knew. It's just now documenting what we already knew and have known for quite some time. We also talked to Florida State Prison Officer Captain Mike Riley about the privatization scheme that went down in defeat in the Florida legislature. And, of course, Alexis Goldstein about the Occupy the SEC letter that they put for the SEC's comment period. Good stuff there. So if you missed any of that, you can go to TheRickSmithShow.com and download the podcast. Or if you got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. I saw this interesting article on homeschooling. And again, there's this whole push, this massive push from the homeschooling industry, which is funded, again, by the billionaire class, to get more people to go, oh, I can do that. There's a lot of opportunities and a lot of things that they've set up, a lot of for-profit stuff that's gotten people, and, oh, I can homeschool. So I'm reading through this article, and I'm thinking, wow, this is a nice sales piece. And it's what I would expect from Useless Today, promoting that, because most people homeschool for religious reasons. Well, they're saying, no, that's not the case anymore. People, they just don't trust public education. And part of me goes, the whole reason for this distrust of public education is all the money that's being thrown in it by the billionaire class. I sat down today with my two kids' teachers. I've got one in kindergarten and one in fourth grade. And, I sat down because of parent-teacher conferences. And, my fourth grader's teacher said, look, there are some days where I just want to get out of this because, as I've said before, they're trying to turn teaching into factory work, where you're going to do this for 6 minutes, you're going to do this for 5 minutes, you're going to do 7 minutes, it's 6 minutes, and they're every moment of every day is incrementally planned out. There's no teaching. There's no professionalism. They're turning it into this robotic activity. But he was saying, I love teaching, but all of this teaching to the test, all of this stuff is really very difficult. And there's not real much about thinking. And he said, there are a lot of things I used to do very differently that got better results. And as I left, I started thinking about the direction of education. And you go back to No Child Left Behind. You go back to all of this standardization. You go back through all of this and you go, why did the right push for this? I understand why the left was pushing for it, because they wanted to pull the bottom schools up, the schools in states that were really struggling. You wanted to have a pulling up, But what it's turned into is a pushing down. These tests have really harmed the kids who are doing well. So if you've got a kid who is going to excel, they're going to sort of be pulled back a little bit in holding back because of these tests. Because the school needs everybody to pass them. And they need to focus on just teaching to that test. And we're forgetting critical thinking. We're forgetting how to solve problems. And, you know, the more I started thinking about it, you know, the whole push towards standardization, the whole push towards the child left, no child left behind, and all of this is to destroy it. The more regulation that you put on it, the more, and I shouldn't even say regulation because I'm in favor of regulations. The more mandates that you put that you don't fund, and the more constrictions of time that you put on so that you don't actually have teaching is kind of how I think it goes down. So you're kind of, and I read this article about homeschooling, and there's part of me that goes, you know, the whole idea is now that we've destroyed the image of public education. Now that the billionaire class has done that, now here's some alternatives. And another way to, you know, to kill off the system earlier. And I'm really worried about this. Because as we see the states walking away from it, we see the federal government kind of walking away from it, the local districts are stuck either raising their property taxes or doing away with programs. I just saw a thing the other day, one of the big school districts talking about, you know, charging people to play sports, which is going to mean that, you know, maybe kids do, maybe they don't. You know, when I was a kid, that was all part of the experience of academics, part of being part of that culture. Now putting up roadblocks everywhere they can. And as I've said a number of times, I think it's for the sole purpose of tearing it down. The more cumbersome you make it, the harder it is to access, the harder it is to get through, the easier it's going to be to destroy. Then we go to this privatization scheme. We go to these private charter schools because, well, my kids, they should go to the best school, and we're being told that these charter schools, these are the best schools. So people are going to think, oh, I got to take my kids out of there, put them over there. We see the statistics. We see the numbers. They're failing. It's a horrible experiment. I go back to my childhood when they tried that busing nonsense. They took poor kids from one side of the town. They shipped into districts that were poor on the other side of town. So you took poor kids from one side of town, took them all the way to the other, and dumped them off in a poor neighborhood, and vice versa. What did that solve? The resources are still crappy on both ends. It didn't solve anything. And that's what I see going on with all of this. All of this shuffling around, it's not solving our problems. Because our real problem is poverty. Our real problem is, you know, the schools that are struggling, the 144 out of 3,300, I think, the ones that are struggling, those are poverty issues more than their kid issues. And I just think we better wake up before it's too late. Anyway, again, if you missed anything on the program, thericksmithshow.com, or if you've got a smartphone, Stitcher app, see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming like a tide.